hey, Confused Breakfast listeners, do not skip ahead. We're removing all pre-roll from this just so you can hear this important message, and then Pulp Fiction will start. We are considering a live podcast in Chicago, Illinois this year. Everything in our backlog says that Chicago is apparently our number one fan listener base with the most fans in it, and we want to know for sure. So if you can do us one quick favor, please, if you are anywhere near the Chicago, Illinois area, click the link in the bio of this episode, wherever you're listening to it, and just put your name in there. That's all we're asking. And you will have first dibs to our tickets when we come. We're just trying to figure out how many people we actually know there. And it's going to be sweet. So without further waiting, because we don't say adieu, let's move on to Pulp Fiction. Well, hello and welcome to the Confused Breakfast. Do you remember the pure joy of a trip to the video rental store as a kid?
Shit, shit.
It's hard to beat the ease of the modern era and streaming platforms where you don't even have to leave your couch, but there was something truly special about heading to Blockbuster to pick out a movie by hand, grabbing some quarter pounders with cheese and Sprites from McDonald's, and heading home to watch. On this podcast, we revisit and dissect some of our favorite childhood movies from that magical era to see if they still move us the way they did as kids. My name is Mike Schulte. Joining me, as always, my pumpkin and my honey bunny, Sean Pryor and AJ Venz. How the heck are ya?
Pretty solid after that score we just took down, huh?
Nobody better f***ing move or I'll execute every last motherf***ing one of ya.
We just said we weren't going to swear in the first couple minutes, and AJ drops two of them.
I didn't do right that.
We'll beep it out.
Can we beep it?
We'll beep it. Those out.
Hang on. Nobody better move or I'll get y'all.
Yeah.
Got it.
Wow. Well, boys, on today's episode, we discuss the second feature film by writer-director Quentin Tarantino.
Yes.
The number 8 highest rated movie on IMDb.
Yes.
A movie that won 69 of 72 awards that it was nominated for.
Nice.
A movie that single-handedly made none of us ever want to go to a pawn shop ever again. We're, of course, talking about 1994's Pulp Fiction.
Right.
Damn, dang it. Ladies and gentlemen, it's time for another nostalgic journey to the past with The Confused Breakfast. Sit back, relax, and enjoy wherever you are in the world. Take it away, boys.
Well, if you're new to this podcast, maybe some of you guys came over from the Brotherly Love podcast. We love you. Welcome here. We're going to be reviewing Pulp Fiction scene by scene with a modern eye. But order to do that properly, we must first discuss it with pure nostalgia. I think we got to start with Sean on this one. Sean, tell us the first time you saw this movie, what your thoughts were about it, and what your nostalgic rating was.
I was getting into movies. I was getting into, like, I had seen Reservoir Dogs. And I wanted more from this filmmaker, and I heard that there was plenty more.
Mm.
But I wasn't allowed to see Pulp Fiction quite yet because I was a little too young, according to my parents.
I guess.
But they listened to the soundtrack nonstop when we were like playing ping pong in my dad's garage. And when they were at work and I was just hanging out in the garage doing whatever, I listened to the soundtrack over and over and over again. And so what I had was these audio clips, because they're in the soundtrack.
Yep.
Tarantino does the audio clips from a movie. What I had was these audio clips, and I had to put it all together in my own brain.
What is
to
this
like,
movie about?
To like, okay, so that is that John Travolta right there? Like, I wonder, is that Tim Roth? That can't be Mr. Orange from Reservoir Dogs. So it was kind of weird that I had to do that. And then along with that, there were soundboards of Sam Jackson on like E-Bomb's World,
yep,
where
oh,
you
yeah
just like prank call people with them. And so I had to put together that and see like what the context is. And I finally saw it, and I loved it. Like it was the best movie I had seen at that point. It's got to be a 10.
10 straight out of the gate nostalgically for Sean. AJ, what about you, man?
There are some movies that I was just too young to watch, and my brother Bob was like old enough.
Too old to watch?
He was too old to watch. And so neither of us ever saw this movie. No, I'm just
I
kidding
wish there was a world where that was true.
You too.
Oh, dude, you're too old for this movie.
But you're too young.
I mean, that's kind of true, right? Because there is a point where you don't want to watch a movie with your mom because it's like too awkward, you
yeah
know?
Oh, yeah.
Mom, you're too old.
Too old.
You should
only watch Titanic with
me. I've got a great story about Titanic when we get there.
Next week.
Yeah.
News to me.
Thank God. No, this is one of those movies that, like, my brother, he would watch these movies, and he would come back and he'd kind of like recite these scenes for me, almost like word for word, like the dialogue and everything. And the Sam Jackson scene with, you know, him reading the verse was one of those scenes. And he would go back and forth and do Sam Jackson. He'd do Brett and back and forth. He'd do Jules and that, the whole thing. And I just remember him doing like the whole, "Oh, I'm sorry. Did I break your concentration?" And I was like, I would just kind of be enthralled with this. Like, he's just telling me another story. And then I finally end up seeing this movie and really piecing it all together. And I just remember thinking like how ridiculous I thought like John Travolta looked in this movie, and things were like silly.
Yeah.
It was like, I couldn't pin the time and like, I couldn't really get it. But then I was like enthralled with it at the same time. So it was a movie that kind of made me constantly think as I'm watching it the first time. So that all being said, did I enjoy it? Yes. Did I probably fake enjoying it more because it was like a movie that like, you better enjoy this movie,
you have to,
or else you just don't even like cinema. Okay.
Sean.
Because of that, I will still give this movie nostalgically a straight up 8.
Straight up 8. I didn't see this movie until college, my freshman year. That's when I got to explore like movies, right? To just go, oh, finally, I get to watch the movies that like I didn't get to watch when I was in high school. And that's when you watch these films that you can be like, oh, well, I understand Pulp Fiction. Like, I'm kind of a, like, you know, me with Boondock Saints, we've talked about it.
Be
like,
Road Trip, old school. As, you guys know, don't just understand. Just discovering this cinema. Yeah.
Memento, like those type of movies where right. I was actually like, no, I understand film.
I'm a big fan of like Blues Brothers and Pulp Fiction. I'm just like Suits.
Yeah, you see, it's not a big deal. It's like kind of, they jump around time all the time. It's hard to understand.
Yeah,
it.
Yeah.
But
you might not get it.
But the first time I saw this, like, whether or not I loved it truly or I was pretending to love it, like, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But it's 9.5. Like, nice. It has to be for me. We got executive producer Michael Giuliano on the show today. He says, I distinctly remember being on our 10th grade trip to Washington, D.C. when someone in our friend group broke out their portable DVD player with some forbidden R-rated DVDs. That night at the hotel, we treated ourselves to a night of debauchery, Euro Trip, Not Another Teen Movie, and Pulp Fiction.
Whoa.
They were the highlights of the night. Unfortunately, by the time Pulp Fiction rolled around, I decided that watching season one of Entourage on my PSP was more worth my time. And wow, that might be the most 2000 sentence I've ever said.
Wow, yeah.
Judging by my friend's reaction, I realized I was missing something good. But hey, we all make mistakes as teenagers. This is unfortunately an NA for me.
Whoa.
So he joins Logan over here. Whoa. I've never seen it.
Log Daddy over there.
I cannot wait to see
that's what
thought.
I'm saying. So we are nostalgically as a group a 9.17.
Got to
and
be.
And if we look at any movie we've done so far, that's going to be number 5, friends. That's going to be just below Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, just above Dumb and Dumber is how we feel about this nostalgically.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. That makes sense. No, it checks out.
Yep. But we're going to wipe that all away. We're going to talk about it with a modern eye. So we got to go to Sean. We got to learn all the important details of the movie. Sean, don't take too long.
I'm going
to
take as long as it needs. Produced by the Lawrence brothers. No, that Lawrence Bender. Richard Gladstein, Stacey Scherr, Michael Schamberg, and Danny DeVito. Based on stories by Quentin Tarantino and Roger Avery, cinematography by Andre Sukula, did Reservoir Dogs, Hackers, and American Psycho.
All right.
Edited by the great Sally Minke, RIP to her. Written and directed by Quentin Tarantino. Cast: John Travolta, Uma Thurman, Samuel L. Jackson, Tim Roth, Amanda Plummer, Ving Rhames, Rosanna Arquette, Eric Stoltz, Bruce Willis, Maria de Medeiros, Peter Green, Alexis Arquette, Harvey Keitel, and Christopher Walken. After the success of Reservoir Dogs, writer and director Quentin Tarantino took a bit of a sabbatical and just straight up went to Amsterdam.
Hmm.
After a few weeks of doing Amsterdam stuff, seeing movies, and reading a bunch of books, Tarantino got to writing but felt like he needed some assistance. He called up collaborator and friend Roger Avery to meet him in Amsterdam so they could flesh out the next project. Initially, the duo wanted to do a few short films, but they quickly realized there was zero interest from investors for such a thing, so the writers decided to combine their respective stories into one film being inspired largely from the anthology film from Mario Bava called Black Sabbath, and crime fiction magazine called Black Mask, which is what they were going to call the film initially. Avery wrote most of the Gold Watch story arc, while Tarantino wrote the other two segments. They had originally wanted a third writer to come on board and write one of the stories, but that didn't work out. Avery was hard up for some cash for his upcoming wedding. I get you there, fella. And because he wanted to get some financing for his directorial debut in Killing Zoe. When it came to casting the film, Tarantino wrote with a few people in mind, including Tim Roth, Samuel Jackson, and Michael Madsen in the role of Vic Vega. Madsen was cast in Wyatt Earp and opted to do that instead. So naturally, Quentin Tarantino had to ask Daniel Day-Lewis. This is what you do when you need some sort of backup.
Oh yeah, yeah. Hey, you're my only backup I can think of, and you weren't my first choice, Daniel Day-Lewis. But hey, can you come and do this movie?
I'm going to need 6 years to prepare.
I don't have that much time.
I'm sorry.
My buddy's getting married, and he needs money. Okay.
Oh, congratulations.
Thanks. Not me, but you know, I'll pass it along.
He declined. Tarantino is a massive John Travolta fan, saying that his performance in Brian De Palma's Blowout is one of the best performances by an actor, period. The two hung out at Tarantino's house, who had pretty much a shrine of Travolta, and played board games after that. Quentin Tarantino was charmed and couldn't get Travolta as Vincent Vega out of his mind. The actor was cast. Quentin wanted Matt Dillon to play Butch, but the actor was unavailable, so by chance, Tarantino was at a party at Harvey Keitel's house where Bruce Willis was also attending. Willis approached Tarantino and said, "Hey, I love your script." Tarantino said, "Thanks," thinking he was talking about Reservoir Dogs. Willis said, "No, Harvey Keitel gave me a copy of your new thing, and I'd love to play either Vincent or Jules." Tarantino was humbled but sad that those parts were pretty much on a lock. He asked Willis to read it again, but have the character of Butch in mind instead, and the actor accepted the role as the boxer. Principal photography began on September 20th, 1993, and shot in L.A. on location and on sets. Tarantino, being the loyal filmmaker he is, pretty much got the whole crew he had worked with previously on Reservoir Dogs, including the same cinematographer, production designers, and producer Lawrence Bender, as well as his ever-important effects crew, in specific the K&B crew for the makeup effects in the film. Jackrabbit Slims was the most costly set on the whole shoot, costing the production $150,000 to construct and furnish. Pulp Fiction was released on May 21st, 1994 at the Cannes Film Festival, where it won the prestigious Palme d'Or, and then released wide on October 14th, 1994. And on a budget of $8 million, the film made $213.9 million at the box office. It was nominated for 7 Academy Awards, including Best Actor for John Travolta, Best Supporting Actor for Sam Jackson, Best Supporting Actress for Uma Thurman, Best Editing, Best Director, Best Picture, and Best Original Screenplay, in which Quentin Tarantino and Roger Avery would win. Thank you, boys.
It's important to note that this movie and The Shawshank Redemption opened on the exact same day.
Ooh.
And yet both of them are in the top 10.
Wow.
Of all movies worldwide on IMDb. In fact, the 95 Oscars, Forrest Gump, Shawshank, Pulp Fiction.
Yeah, we might have to do a 90, best five in
94. 94 is, it might be one of the best years ever.
Ice Cube would call that a good day.
Well, up next, we got to go to AJ. He does the research for us, talks about the ratings and reviews from critics and fans alike. What do you got, bro?
I wish I could say this myself, but I think it's more important that...
It's the tomato meter. Gross.
Who was that?
That is Chase.
Chase.
That's Jen's son. She messages often on Instagram and just...
Says that her son just likes to do that.
Loves the show, her and her husband, and yeah.
So your son is on a good path.
Yeah.
We're just letting you know this.
I've never been more flattered in my life. And now I'm going to be honest.
If he's still listening, you may want to turn it
you
off.
May, from this point on, maybe this is the end of his listening for this show.
Yes. Unfortunately, for whatever reason, we skipped Surf Ninjas and decided to go to Pulp Fiction to add that in there.
We didn't have our thing.
We didn't have things, man.
We didn't have the thing, okay?
Thanks,
guys.
Chase. Appreciate you, buddy.
Jen, thank you guys so much for listening. And you did it better than I've ever done in the history of this show.
That's correct.
So thanks, Sean. 92% certified fresh,
hey,
daddy-o.
Listen to this company of any movie we've done. That is tied with Dazed and Confused, Jurassic Park, Rocky, Shaun of the Dead.
Wow.
Ugh. Yeah, all terrible movies.
Stinkers.
Oh, man. Huge discrepancy here, guys. The audience scored it at a 96%. So huge discrepancy. Mm-hmm. On IMDb, this is an 8.9.
Any Whoa. Guesses where that falls number-wise of all the movies we've done?
Days I want to say we've done a... I feel like we've done a 9.0, have nope. we? Or is this number one?
Princess Bride.
Nope. 8.9 is number one of any movie we have done on IMDb. That is better than The Matrix, Goodfellas, Saving Private Ryan, and T2.
Wow. It's better than all of them.
Better than all of those.
It's better than everything that you could ever think of. Let's see here, guys. I wanted to bring this one up. This was done in 2000. As with any landmark movie, more has been written about it than would surely seem healthy. The type of wild and hysterical ranting that has surrounded the picture can be a little off-putting, but it's hard to oversell a movie that is so supremely confident in writing and direction. Despite an almost audience-annihilating runtime of nearly 2.5 hours, it is consistently absorbing. 100 out of 100, Empire said, a scintillating piece of filmmaking, the kind of movie you look forward to seeing again even as you're watching it. And an extraordinary response to both the dogs is overrated brigade and the he'll never top his debut skeptics.
Wow.
Austin Chronicle 100, again, very satisfying. Classic storytelling, modern techniques, and the images. The movie has embedded so many strange and new mental pictures in my head that I'm not able to shake free. Yet, neither would I want to be free. Variety said that Pulp Fiction is the American Graffiti of violent crime pictures. Chicago Sun-Times says, like Citizen Kane, Pulp Fiction is constructed in such a nonlinear way that you could see it a dozen times and not be able to remember what comes next.
Nice.
This is a 1 out of 10.
Okay.
There are some of these that exist, so it's important to go over them. I was always wondering why everyone loved this film. If you can see where it's going, this is September 12th, 2023. I think the plot of the film is unclear and too random. It does not have a strong plot or plot twist or something that makes the story enjoyable and the desire to wait until the end. I don't know why everyone defy this film. Missed that one. To be honest, when I watch this, I just want the film to end as soon as possible. I'm too lazy to see a messy and untraceable plot. The character's background also goes back and forth and is confusing. There is no impression as if A causes B to become C. There's just A happening, C happening, B happening, X happening, and it's so weird. Ready to accept attacks. From Pulp Fiction fans worldwide.
Here it comes.
I'm not going to come for you, man.
You know what?
You're just too dumb to understand it.
I don't think he's worth it.
Flip it and reverse it.
I'm so unbelievably excited for you to hear this scene-by-scene breakdown of Pulp Fiction, but first, a shout-out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples. I'm going to let you in on some personal info. I've been an allergy sufferer my entire life, like really bad. I had allergy shots once a month, one in each arm for like 10 years as a kid. I was allergic to everything. Luckily, those shots helped, but seasonal allergies have really been getting me bad lately. Seems like every spring, I'm congested as heck for weeks at a time with runny, itchy nose, sneezing at a constant. And with how warm it's been in the Midwest, I'm already feeling miserable. Last weekend was the worst. It's so frustrating, and I haven't really been able to figure out what to do to help. And luckily, Astapro has the answers I've been looking for. Here's why you need to join us if you suffer from allergies. Astapro is a first of its kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over the counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing. I use this. You should, too. Now that I have Astapro in my life, whenever I wake up and my nasal allergies are flaring up, I use it, and it's absolutely insane how fast I'm back up and feeling better. Confused Breakfast listeners can also get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to Astapro.com. AstaProAllergy.com for a discount so you can Astapro and go today. That's AstaProAllergy.com. AstaPro and go. Uses directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies. Well, boys, I want you to listen to this phrase.
Okay.
Here we go. Now, I've been saying that shit for years, and if you ever heard it, that meant your ass was about to hear us talk about scene one. I never gave much thought to what it meant. I just thought it was a cold-blooded thing to say to a motherfucker before I popped a Mike's fan theory in his ass. But I saw some shit this morning that made me think twice. See, now I'm thinking, maybe it means you're the evil man, I'm the righteous man, and Mr. SM7B here, he's the shepherd protecting my righteous asses in the valley of darkness. Or it could mean you're the righteous man and I'm the shepherd and that the world is evil and selfish. And I'd like that, but that shit ain't the truth. The truth is you're the audience and I'm the guy that's going to kick off the scene-by-scene breakdown. But I'm trying, Ringo. I'm trying real hard to be the shepherd. Here we go.
Here we are.
So scene one, the movie starts with a couple deciding to rob a restaurant. After this, hitmen Jules and Vincent arrive at an apartment to retrieve a briefcase for their boss, gangster Marcellus Wallace. After Vincent checks the contents of the briefcase, Jules shoots two of the people inside. They take the briefcase to Marcellus and wait while he bribes boxer Butch Coolidge to take a dive in his upcoming match. The next day, Vincent purchases heroin from his drug dealer, Lance.
This cold open may be one of the greatest of all time. I don't like, there's a lot of them out there for sure, but just like getting you into, they are in the middle of a conversation when this movie starts.
Right in the goddamn middle.
Yeah. And then, like, it's Tim Roth and Amanda Plummer. Like, when he cast them, he had them in mind. He just saw them together at, like, a party or something. Like he's them. Like, you guys are in my movie as Honey Bunny and Pumpkin.
How do I get to that party where I could just be, like, it's kind certain of acting cool and be like, oh, Tarantino's going to be there. So you got to talk to me like I'm cool. And then I'm, like, smoking cigarettes weird. You got to don't smoke cigarettes. You know,
sitting weird in your chair.
Yeah, like trying to not be uncomfortable like I always am. Yeah.
But it's also really fucking cool because you can hear Jules and Vincent's conversation in the background.
So, Sean, you know how much I love doing this podcast with you because I am very observational in movies. I love, like, finding stuff. But, like, I look so much harder when we're about to do our review that I see shit that I've watched this movie 40 times. You see Vincent walk past them.
Yeah, I was going to bring this up.
And I never, ever noticed that.
I was literally trying to find the timestamp. I was, like, while the intro was playing, I had it right here. And I was like, oh, where's it happen? And I believe it's just something. I think it's over the shoulder of Honey Bunny.
And it's just barely. He's, like, sort of way off to the side. And you would never know it. No. Ever.
And like, unless you've seen it 90,000 times, you know, like it's really cool because I do believe that they bump the audio on that point too. Like they bring that in over the other chatter going on in the cafe. And it's just really cool. There's other times in the movie that I'll bring up too, where it's like the audio mixing is really kind of underrated in this because I'll bring it up later, but also, you know, you can hear Honey Bunny and Pumpkin in the last scene, and then he shows them, obviously. But it's great. I mean, you just get fucking Dick Dale, right?
Yeah, like right off the bat.
Yeah, it's so good.
It's I would wait till the end, but I'm sure by the time we get there, I'm gonna forget about it. So I'm just gonna say it now. The dialogue that you hear from Honey Bunny, that line that she says when she stands up on the table or when they're standing up, is different from the dialogue in the end. And if you, I think it might have been a commentary that Tarantino, they're like, oh yeah, you didn't catch that flub. It's like, that was not a flub. This is a perception. It's all about the perception of us, of you hearing it from them and what happens, and then also hearing it from the perspective of Jules and Vincent and hearing it differently. And it's like, I feel like you could have made that up. But at the same time, I have nothing to back it up.
But see, that has always bugged me.
Yeah.
This is the first time she says, motherfucking last one of you.
Last one, yeah.
And by the way, there's a band called Fun Loving Criminals. I think I've talked about them. They sample that line in a song called Scooby Snacks.
Okay.
So everybody knows that. So that's the one that I know and I hear it in my head. But then the second time she says, every one of you motherfuckers.
Yes.
And it bothers me. And I read
first
that
one is every last one of you. Sorry.
Every motherfucking last one of you.
Yeah. Right.
And it bugs me, and I don't like that explanation at all. I don't like that.
You don't think it's valid?
I don't know if it is valid or not, but I don't care. Like, it just bugs me. Still, and it doesn't need to be that way. Like, just make it the same.
Sure.
That and along, like, why does she, her mouth freezes, like, she keeps talking, but she freezes before she ends the sentence? Little things like that, I can't decide if I like or not.
It's very 90s. It's very just like, this is a whole new movie that no one's ever seen before, and he's going to do different shit. I don't know.
I think that's an interesting take on it, too, is like when you know, we get to watch these movies so much later and like after the fact, right? But if you were to go and see this in the theater on the release day, you know, whatever it is, you chose to go see this instead of Shawshank Redemption, right?
Yeah.
And you're like, oh my gosh, what's going on?
Yeah.
You know? It is. It's kind of almost revolutionary.
It is.
Yeah.
I'm not, I just don't like the different dialogue thing, but the freeze frame, like I'm in.
Yeah.
Like I'm just like, it was a creative choice, but I'm down with it. I don't.
It's like the shortest Mandela effect ever.
Yeah. but I'll tell you what, like if they had not started with this and they had just started with the intro, as good as the music is, it's way too long.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
but the fact that I know what I'm getting into now and that I've already seen this intro, I'm cool with it.
Yeah.
Mostly because of the music. But like, don't you feel like this intro just kind of like, come on, get to the fucking movie.
I don't know, man. I am someone who like, especially with like prestigious directors like this, you know, I am someone who loves a cool fucking intro, like credits intro kind of thing. It's boring, I guess, but like you get it's fucking rock and roll with Dick Dale, and then you change the channel.
The radio station change is one of my favorite things.
That's just a Tarantino thing, basically, isn't it?
Kind of a lot of the times, a lot, and like especially in this movie, it is his like more omniscient, I think, is the word to use, where the music in the movie is happening.
It's in their
the world.
Scene.
Yeah.
Because doesn't it fade out and then it's pretty much in their car?
Yeah, like Jungle Fever.
Right as you come out of that, they're listening to that in the car.
Yeah.
Which is just like, ugh, so perfect.
You see them in this car and they look like they're out of the 70s.
It feels
very
like 70s, doesn't it?
Right? But this is 90s.
But maybe it's the music.
It has to be. It's the movies. It's the car.
The look.
It's their look, the suits, the hair.
That warm LA glow that's always kind of coming through windows from the sun, from like the low sun.
It's just this outside shot and like, you know, Vincent's hair is blowing and like in the wind. And they're also kind of having this conversation. Again, it's kind of a mid conversation thing. It's, you know, him talking about Amsterdam and, you know, it's the little differences, you know. You know, you can go into a movie theater and get a glass of beer. I'm not talking about no paper cup. I'm talking about a glass of beer, you know? And it's the way that he's describing things, and like it really comes back to that Tarantino dialogue that I just really like. It's pointless conversation that seems important. I don't know.
It sucks you right in. It's impossible to turn away from any frame of this movie, even when it's just people talking.
It's because it's just cool. It's real cool talk.
Yeah.
That not many people would know how to write.
Mm-hmm.
Not many people can talk really cool in real life.
Yeah.
But for them, they make it, the dialogue makes it seem so effortless that you just want to like, you just want to be, it's like the future version of podcasts where you just want to listen to people talk and just go, oh,
right.
I love this conversation.
Like when
having,
you get you know? When you're reading a book with like a really good author who is just like the prose is like why, like you could even care less about the story, but just the words itself is just like so infectious and like, oh, I want to use that word, or I didn't know they put mayonnaise on French fries in Holland instead of ketchup, you know, like shit like that too, where it's like, I didn't know that. I've never been to Amsterdam.
No.
Yeah. And it's how does it pick up where he just says, so get this. It's legal to buy it. It's legal to have it. It's legal to like sell it.
If you're the proprietor of the hash bar,
it's legal to sell it. And like just going on through, and he's just like, "I'm going, man. I'm going tomorrow."
I know, baby. Like you dig it the most.
You dig it the most, man. And like you just know that they have this history. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's another thing too. I'm glad you said that. They seem like fucking great friends.
Yes.
Yeah. And I don't know how long they've known each other. Maybe this is like their first thing.
But they spend so much time together for one job. Like, how long have they already been in the car this morning?
Like, a lot of their scenes reminds me of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and Cliff Booth and Rick Dalton's relationship, where it's just like, I would watch these guys do fucking anything.
Yeah, they should have their own buddy show or
something.
They should have a podcast.
People should hear our conversation.
They should do it. They should record it in the car.
Oh,
they're just driving around, dude.
I'm already sucked in, and I'm like trying to be critical, but I'm like just putting my phone down just to like enjoy it. This choice to make them come up to the door, they're still having their conversation, to make them go, yeah, it's not time yet, to have them go down the hallway, but the camera stays where it's at and they finish their conversation. No one would ever make that choice back in like 95.
Come on, man. Let's get into character.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a big one-er shot.
Yes.
It's a big one-er shot.
That camera would normally break and then go up to them and follow them there and like get close up on their faces. Yeah. This one doesn't. Mm-hmm. And it's so great. And like, but why is it not time yet? Do they ever say that, Sean?
I think they're just extreme professionals. Like, because what we learned to find out is that Marvin is like the...
He's an informant, right?
For him. So he's like, be here at this time, maybe, is kind of my thinking of it. Where it's like, be here at this time, and so they're going to be there at that time. You know? Like, no matter, even if they're early, fuck that. Like, right on the dot, they're going to be there at 6:30 or some shit.
And it gives us time to finish this conversation. And then we go.
By the way, think of it from, like, the other side of that door, and think about how long they're outside that door hanging out, and those guys are still just sitting there, like, eating their burger, and, like, they're about to just get blown away.
They don't even know it.
And, like, think about the guy who ended up going into the bathroom. Had they actually gone in at that time, that guy would have been standing there.
I'm glad you brought it up, because I think a lot of what this movie is about is like just like chance and time.
Yeah.
And I think that's why it's so brilliant, why this movie is like split up the way it is, because I think even too, we'll get to a bunch more scenes where this point will relate to it, but I think that there's something to say about like a lot of things wouldn't happen if just this one thing didn't happen. And that's kind of like what goes on through this movie. I, after watching this, I like went to work and was thinking, like, you know what? I don't know what a lot of Tarantino movies are like really about.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, like you could say, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood's mostly like about Hollywood, and that's even about chance too. But like, I didn't really see a point in Pulp Fiction. I just watched it because it was so fucking cool and good,
right?
But I think there's a lot to say about like theology and chance and time, especially like watching it over three times in the past week.
Well, can we? I want to come back to that later too. Yeah. Can we just take 1 second though to talk about Sam Jackson?
Yeah.
And like, this is where like he's so good in this whole movie, but this whole scene, like, look at the big brain on Brad, which is weird. By the way, he says Brad. He totally says Brad.
He says Brad.
Yeah. And his name's Brett. Yeah. But like, whatever. When he's drinking the Sprite and he's making the eye contact while he's just slurping it up, I'm not talking to you, flock of seagulls. Like, this whole moment, to me, is the reason why any of us know who Sam Jackson is.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like if this scene does not happen and he is not so perfect in this movie, he's not who we know him to be.
Like, you could argue that he's the star of the movie, and like he has probably more screen time than John Travolta, even though they're mostly on screen together.
John was lead actor and he was supporting actor. Yeah. That's strange, but I mean, I know.
Yeah, it's. I mean, I think it's just politics. You know, the politics for an award show. But
as we go through, the only consistent character through all the lines is Vincent.
It's true. He is in everyone. There you go.
It's kind of like his. It's almost like his telling.
It sort of is.
Sure.
It's just kind of a scary thing.
Well, before we get into most of this scene, what do you guys think? Is a foot massage and eating someone out in the same ballpark?
Yeah.
Think so?
Yeah.
I mean, would you, of course. You ever give a guy a foot massage?
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
Fuck you. Vincent's absolutely right. Like, if someone gave my fiance a foot massage, you'd be like, that is sensual touching.
Yeah.
And I will throw you out a fucking window.
Yeah. It is on that point of like, you know what? You gotta take a step back. Like, but I like how, I'm sure we'll bring it up later when we get to Jackrabbit Slims, but I like the way that these stories are told from different perspectives. And I think it kind of, again, it's going to tie back to all about perspective, even when we're talking about that first line from Honey Bunny and hearing it again later on. It's all about perspective. And, you know, Mia's version and telling of that is sure. very different from Jules and from Vincent, and like the way that people, it's like this telephone game throughout the entire movie. It's interesting.
That's a good point.
But I would touch her feet. She's got great feet.
She's got great feet.
He shoots feet like no one else. Yeah. I love when they first walk in and Flocus Eagles is like kind of getting up. He's like, hey, no, keep chilling. He's like, keep chilling.
Come on, keep chilling.
Trying to put his feet back up.
And he's like, put your feet back up.
This is one tasty burger.
On the note of Sam Jackson, I do believe this is his best role of all time.
I think so.
It's hard to top this. But of all of the amazing stuff he's done, this is just fucking...
This is my Sam Jackson.
Yeah. It's his movie almost to me. Like,
we'll talk about it as we go, but if this movie is not what it is, if it's not for the people that are in the roles and them doing the absolute... 10 out of 10 best performance that they could possibly do with it.
Because
it's not the same. It's not believable if these guys aren't doing the way they are in this movie.
I'm sure they're eating it up too, man, with this dialogue. It's just like, how can they not just be in this universe as good as they are, you know?
Yeah. One thing to note on Sam Jackson before we do move on, because I have a question for you guys. The wigs, man, like the hair for both of these characters is like top tier, but also obnoxious. Yep. But then these are like the two guys that you would not say anything to them if you thought their hair was ridiculous.
No, which is maybe why it's so bad.
Yeah.
Because nobody tells them.
No one's going to tell them. Like, it's like this. It's like, dude. And Sam Jackson is supposed to, they tried like several different like large afros. That they wanted for Sam Jackson's character. And they had one that was like this Jerry Curl kind
of.
They
threw some Soul Glow on it.
Yeah, yeah.
Soul Glow!
Because it's always shiny.
Soul Glow! but they've tried it on, and I think it must have been Sam Jackson that was just like, this is the one. This is the one.
And he just wanted to walk around with it, with the big old two sideburns on the side.
Yeah, and it was the same, borderline the same story for Vincent. He was supposed to be a more like clean cut.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. He was going to be like his brother Vic Vega. Yeah.
That's right.
But see? No, he's like no.
So, is it my question to you guys? Is it worth diving into what's in the briefcase?
This is the time to ask the questions.
Okay.
You know what the one thing that this movie doesn't have that it could have added and it would have made it so much better? Pets. That's the one thing we can all relate to, and this movie has none of it. You know how much I love my pet, Sergeant Meowenstein. He is a black cat, and he is the best boy in the world. And I know that you can relate to that. I know you love your animal, and I want you to picture this. You're at the vet's office again, and you know that vet care costs continue to rise, and you're anxiously waiting to hear how expensive the bill will be. But if you had pet insurance, your pet could be covered for accidents or illnesses. That's why you should check out our sponsor today, ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like us to help get the pet care we may need. The ASPCA Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during this time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure that your particular pet's plan is as unique as they are. Because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. That is always when it happens. It's simple. Use their app, submit a claim, and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/breakfast. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/breakfast. Again, aspcapetinsurance.com/breakfast. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance. Does anybody have a definitive answer of what you think's in the briefcase?
No. I mean, my definitive answer is de facto, and probably Tarantino's answer is whatever you want.
Okay. But like, let's have some fun.
Yeah, here. Sure.
Do you have any theories? I've scoured the internet for theories.
I know that it's one of them is Marcellus's soul, and that's why he's got the Band-Aid on the back of his
head. Because there's traditional folklore that the devil does pull your soul from the back of your head.
Okay.
There is folklore about that.
The thing I watched said there's nothing.
Well, we're going to... Shut up, Sean. which is also like the 666 on the briefcase, which, by the way, Mason came back from L.A. and TSA had searched his briefcase. And the dude left it on 666.
Oh. What a jerk.
No, how awesome is that?
Fuck yeah, dude.
That's the devil rifling through your shit?
That's metal, dude.
Fucking Slipknot, bro, dude. Fuck yeah.
No, dog. Like,
all right, what do you got?
Mine was pretty much in line with that. Now, the other one that I want it to be.
Okay.
This is what I want it to be. But to my understanding, there's no possible valid way, but I wanted it to be the diamonds from Reservoir Dogs.
I like that one a lot.
Yeah.
And that fits well. What about Wonka's golden ticket? What about
What
about Gwyneth Paltrow's head from Seven?
Okay.
But I do want to be honest with you. This one, I heard from Paul Scheer. Okay. He read this on a Pulp Fiction thing, and he got it from a Reddit thread that is no longer. But I've found where it is. And this one, at first I laughed at, but then I was like, dude. So here, he thinks that rock and roll is in the briefcase. So Pulp Fiction was about music in America. The briefcase is rock and roll. Marcellus represents the origin of rock music in America. Jules is Chuck Berry, Vincent is Elvis. They go to get the briefcase back from the nerdy white guys trying to steal their music. Maybe they represent greedy record producers that profited off of black music, screwed over black musicians. The reason the guy that unloads the gun on them is unable to hit him is because legends of music can never die and will be around forever. Jules realizes this and realizes he's fighting a pointless fight. Pumpkin and Honey Bunny happen to be British, and they also take the briefcase. They represent the British invasion. The British invasion was completely influenced by blues and older pop music. Jules lets them leave with the money, but he keeps his bad motherfucker wallet because they can steal and be influenced by the music, but they can't take the style. They have to come up with their own style. Jules even mentions that he's trying real hard to be a shepherd. Butch is introduced as the boxer, being told by Marcellus to throw a fight. Butch represents new and interesting rock music that continues to come out that Marcellus doesn't like. Butch doesn't throw the fight and runs away. They both get captured by rednecks while a country song is playing. The rapists represent country music. Country music also stole a lot from the blues and other black music. This is shown by them raping Marcellus. Butch has a chance to escape but decides to go back to save him out of respect. Marcellus agrees to let Butch live and they truce go separate ways. Marcellus accepts that there will always be new music and there's nothing he can do to stop it. The watch represents that as time moves on, more new music continues to come in and be made, and they will all be influenced by what came before them.
Wow.
Boom. You heard it here first.
That is yeah.
Like, this is not correct. Like, this is not right. But it's a very cool way to look at
you know what I'm
the character.
Do?
I still feel compelled.
I'm going to go watch the movie again and think about that and have a little fun with it.
And pretend that each of these characters represent music.
Just have a little fun with it.
Nah, I don't think you'll have fun. I think you'll hate it.
Sounds like it's going to ruin my good time, and I just want to tell the world
it's
how much
it's just a movie.
thanks, Paul Scheer and whoever wrote that on Reddit, because it's not out there anymore. But he brought it to my attention. So.
That is awesome. I really like that a lot.
I love that.
I also like to think that what is actually in there, because Jules says it later in the film, is, oh, my boss's dirty laundry. Like, it's just like a fucking sick jacket.
It's like a gold-plated dildo.
Gold sequin fucking, like, Michael Jackson replica or some shit.
Yeah.
Like, it just... prize possession.
What if it was Michael Jackson's glove?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
Let's but it go. Was two light bulbs and a battery. It's
well, of course. Okay, yeah. Okay. Yeah. What do you think? So after this, they do go to see Marcellus. They go to that dope. Talk about bars you want to hang out in.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I want to hang out in this red lounge that they got.
The strip club?
Yeah, the strip club, right? But in the daytime when nobody's there.
Oh, sure.
I do have a question. Do they ever address this hostility between Butch and Vincent?
No, I think Vincent is just coming off of like a bad day.
obviously,
it's been a bad day.
Yeah. Think about where this is in their day,
and now
they finally see.
Now they're poking fun of him for taking out Mia later that night.
They're still egging that one on.
And he's a little annoyed.
He's annoyed with that one. You got to remember, he's wearing the clothes that were given to him by Jimmy after he shot Marvin in the face, had to clean up all the brain matter and the inside of this car, and like after everything he has been through. That's, and then it's like, what are you staring at, Punchy?
Punchy.
Yeah. Palooka.
Palooka. Yeah. Well, and this is what, John, this is one of the movies where it makes so much sense. Like, you envy someone that has never seen this before.
Oh, my God.
Because the first time you watch this, when you're like, what the fuck are they wearing? Because you just have no idea what has happened.
The immediate next scene, they're not like, wearing suits
anymore.
Oh, did
they just change? Or what? I don't understand what happened.
Yeah. USC banana slugs.
It's awesome.
I really like these interactions. And again, I think this is one of those movies that you... One of the reviews says it, that you kind of almost want to keep... You want to rewatch it while you're watching it, and you watch it once and you're like, well, now I want to watch it again because I want to make these connections, even that they make so subtly in these interaction scenes.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know what I mean? There'll be one coming up. I guess we're already inside of it because, this is still scene one where, Vince does go and get drugs from Lance.
Yeah.
And he says, man, somebody, he's like, you know what? I've had it out 5 days and somebody keyed my car, my Malibu. He's like, man, that is just wrong. And then you start putting it together after this interaction in the bar that Butch is the he is the one who keyed his car.
And how he doesn't know that.
Yeah.
Well, and then like, it's funny how Butch probably walked out of the bar. He's like, that's probably that asshole's car.
He's like, of course that's his car. You know, that like it's got the hair to match. You know what
he's
I mean?
He's got that shitty Honda, and he's right. Driving this car. He's like, God damn it!
It's like, of course it is. Oh, dude, but those are the little connections that you just you keep getting a taste of, mm-hmm. and you do need to rewatch, and you have to pay attention. You have to put your phone down. You got to turn the lights off. Do whatever you got to do so you can pay attention to these details of these types of movies, man.
Ving Rhames is Marcellus. I love how they don't show him quite yet.
Yeah.
It's the best when, like, even in, like, kind of Reservoir Dogs, how they turned away from, I believe that was Marvin, too, of getting, Marvin Nash, getting his ear cut off.
Marvin Nash.
Marvin Nash.
Nash with a G.
Nash.
Why is that so funny?
That's
good. Gosh. My mom's now.
I know you're a cop.
Freddie Vachetti. Yeah. But no, it's like it is just like a like I know that he's pulling from like Sergio Leone,
yeah.
Kind of like not showing the bad guy quite yet, you know, not showing the big bad quite yet.
When is the technical first time you see him? It's at the crosswalk when he turns his head and goes, "Motherfucker!" I think that's the first time you see his face.
Oh no, I think you're right because he is turned around when he's like, "I would scour the earth for that motherfucker."
Isn't that weird?
Yeah.
So the first time you're watching this, you're like, is that Marcellus?
Yeah.
But the idea of just leaving a Band-Aid on the back of his neck for no reason and there not being a significance to it, that's like a comic book frame.
Mm-hmm.
Like that that shot is like a comic book frame. And like it's like this is the big bad and he's got this Band-Aid on the back of his neck.
Yeah.
And it's like, but why? And there's never an explanation. You know, that's really given.
You can do it. That's why whether all of this stuff was intentional by Quentin or whether it wasn't, it doesn't matter. Because if you can write a script good enough to let fan theories get in there, whether it was true or not, whether you meant it or not, that just shows you how good it is.
Just to instigate this type of,
because it's just so open. It's like, I don't know, maybe the fucking devil took it out of his brain. His soul's gone.
And that it's worth it. It's worth to look at a different way. Mm-hmm. You know, like any of the movies that we do that we have these theories on.
No, fan theories are not worth it. Stop wasting your
time.
You have way too much time on your hands.
Just enjoy it.
Yeah.
But yeah, they like in all seriousness, it is worth it. Yeah.
It is.
Like this is art and it's worth being discussed and it's worth maybe someone saying like, oh, I saw it this way. And like if you know, someone's angered by that, I don't know what to do with you. You know, like it's not even just that it's a fucking great movie. It's that you're right. It does offer those things. It offers those kind of like the questions that aren't answered, you have to fill in on your own. And that's, I think Tarantino is deliberate in that, and most of it anyway.
One of the reviews, I kind of chose to just not read it because it was a little long-winded and it was another 1 out of 10. And it was mostly one of the first things that this guy says is, you know, Tarantino is so self-esteemed is the words he used, but I don't think that's the right thing.
Yeah, I don't think
but so. It's like, it reminds me of, maybe I should have fucking read it.
No, you're reading like, it now. It's all good.
I'm not reading it now, but it's like, okay, well, one, you messed that up, but at the same time, it's like, I get it, like self-involved or like, you know, it's like, it's the equivalent of, it insists upon itself, yeah. Right? And I get it. But at the same time, these are the movies that you watch not for like, not to be spoon-fed.
Yeah.
And that is like, if you didn't have people who were coming up with these types of fan theories, like surrounding this movie, like, I don't know what to tell you. Mm-hmm. It's what makes it so fun, I guess. So rewatchable.
It's got to be personal with these directors that we cover, like Scorsese and Tarantino and De Palma even, or anything like that. It's all these stories are probably personal to them, especially being a writer-director mm-hmm. like Quentin Tarantino is. It's got to be that way, you know? Jordan Peele, I think, says it too. He's like, I wanted to make my movie because I wanted to see a movie I hadn't seen yet, or I wanted to see a movie that no one had made yet because I hadn't made it.
Right.
And that's what these guys are doing.
That's so important. There's so much like the world just gets so caught up in trying to recreate something that it saw before or that made the big box office hit.
Literally, and then that's happening.
They try to redo it, sometimes even to the point of remaking a movie that doesn't need to be remade. And that's all that comes out. And then you finally get a Jordan Peele or a Tarantino that will create something, thank God, that we haven't seen yet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let's do scene two. So after shooting up, Vincent drives to meet Marcellus's wife, Mia, to take her out for dinner. They eat at Jackrabbit Slim's, participate in a twist contest, and then return home. While Vincent is in the bathroom, Mia overdoses. Vincent rushes her to Lance's house, where they revive her with an injection of adrenaline into the heart. Vincent drops Mia off at her home, and the two agree never to tell Marcellus about the incident.
So one of the packets of heroin is called Bava, which is Mario Bava, the director, okay. Which is who made Black Sabbath.
This is Bava.
That it's
very good.
This is inspired the multiple stories. Anyway,
nice.
You guys go.
How good is Eric Stoltz in this, though?
No, he's one of my favorite performances in this for some odd reason.
I just like that it's that's who, because like the majority of drug dealers, that's who they are.
Is that right?
I'm not saying I've ever. I've never been to a
heroin den.
How do you know?
I've gone with friends before. Okay?
Oh, okay.
But like, it's always like along. The dude that's just in his house.
You don't
house.
Just go with a friend to a heroin.
Yes, you do. Like, that's what it's like.
Hey, I'm going to Walmart real quick.
Yeah. Hey, man, you just don't know the right people, all right, dude?
I guess.
I have problems in movies sometimes when people are acting drunk or acting stoned.
Yeah.
When you're like, yeah, just get stoned and do it because you're not. You're not buying. I'm not buying it. Now, I have never done heroin, but like I 100% believe that Vincent Vega just shot up when he's driving through the city and just going and the breeze is in his hair when he fucking like how slow he walks up the driveway and he kind of like bumps into a plant.
Yeah.
And the most gift amazing thing of all time of him inside the house going, ugh.
Oh, dude.
And he's holding the jacket like. I love John Travolta so much in this role.
All right, are we talking about him now?
Let's do it. This is his big scene.
Big, like, comeback, pretty much. You know, Tarantino, like, rediscovering John Travolta that, like, he ever fucking left, you know?
Because he was, like, Grease stardom. Then he kind of fell out. Then
look,
I think...
Look Who's Talking movies was, like, what he was doing, you know?
And it was... The first one was, like, kind of a big deal.
Yeah,
but then I think it did fall off again to... Before this,
like,
right?
You're making three of them, really?
It means it's popular. We're gonna do this.
Something's going right.
We're gonna do it at some point.
Good paycheck.
Yeah.
Seeing those movies, you know, coming from like Look Who's Talking and everything like that, and he, like, that's not really a character. He's just kind of serving the plot. You know, with what's her name?
Kirstie Alley.
Thank you.
Alley.
And then, like, I would say
Ooh, the
Grease,
baby talks.
Yeah.
Oh, that's funny.
Now the dog talks. Uh-huh.
Look Who's Talking, man. Too.
Also. Oh.
Who's going to talk next?
PG-13.
And then he's fucking shoots up some heroin. Now the chair talks. Yeah. But, like, I would say, like, Grease is a character. Like, he's playing a Johnny. Right?
Yeah, whatever.
He's Johnny playing, Grease. I think that's...
Grease Lightning, right?
His name's
like,
Johnny
this
Grease
This is,
Lightning.
Like, comeback to, like... A character, like something to chew on,
showing
for
his chops.
Yeah, like his he talks different in this. You know, he talks like, you know, kind of talks like Sam Jackson would in some of these things. But I don't know. He's really, really fucking good in this. And I think it's really just because it's, like I've been saying, a character and not just like, fill this role for me, would you, please?
This is a real believable character that this guy can, like you said, chew on.
Yeah.
I'd like to believe that this could happen in the real world, but I know it wouldn't. But can't we just believe that Jackrabbit Slims can be a place that we would all go to and that it would be successful?
I don't know why it's not a chain. I think they tried.
Like in Milwaukee?
Or like a pop-up for like a few months somewhere in LA or something like that. Oh, like, that'd be great. Why don't you just do that? Like, just pick a warehouse and fill it with all this bullshit.
Because you can't.
Get some chefs.
Because you get some chefs.
Just do it.
Just get a chef and some race cars.
Yeah, that's all you gotta fucking do. And the problem is that because you can't hire people based on how they look to play these characters. That's why it could never happen.
You have
anymore.
To let me play Marilyn Monroe, or else you'll be hearing from my attorney. It's like, fuck, that's like, the end of our business.
There it goes.
You're not Marilyn Monroe, so fucking whatever.
People are supposed to buy this, okay? They need to buy into this for at least, you know, at least a few seconds.
This is the place I would go all the time.
Hands down.
Do you remember Ragtop Diner in Cedar Rapids? Mm-mm. It was where Panera is on Council Street. It was kind of like this. Like, if they played oldies music.
Wasn't Bebop's kind of like that?
Yeah, I don't think Bebop's was like that. But they had, like, milkshakes, and they had, like, old-time food, and like, the booths were kind of like cars, sort of. Not to that extent.
Was that near Chapman's at all?
No, not at all. Okay, no.
No, I don't remember that, but that sounds fucking
I just
fantastic.
Think it was more of an old-timey thought, but now it's people are like, well, why would I go there if I can go to Applebee's?
Sure.
The new Cheesecake Factory's next door. Fuck
yeah. Yeah, they got plenty of, you know, crazy shit on the wall. It's like, why I got to go to the Jackrabbit Slim's place? Pay too much
crazy shit on the wall.
Yeah, what's the name of that place with all the chicken and the crazy shit on the wall?
Oh, you mean Shenanigans?
Oh, you mean Jackrabbit Slim?
You mean Jackrabbit Slim?
Oh. No. I'd be remiss to miss out on the Warrior shot, the mic and close-up mouth. We talked about it when we did Warriors, and
that's a tribute to that, right?
Tribute to Warriors, yeah. He loves that movie. But yeah, like this the whole set of this thing is fucking immaculate, dude. And it's fucking really cool. we talk about it, but like, yeah, I would fucking really go.
The race cars on that track, and again, the grandeur of it, that one-er shot that follows him around, just.
Yeah,
like, dude, he's high right now. Imagine what's going through his head. But do you notice again? He walks past them. He walks past their booth. Again, I never even thought to see that because he's looking off to the left and he just passes Vincent. Oh, that's
right here.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. And he comes back. I mean, and to your point again, you don't even see Mia. You only see her lips. You hear her talking. You see her legs, her feet. In the back of her head, and then you don't see her like her face in the until the
wow,
car.
Wow, that's crazy.
When she says, "Don't be a quadrilateral."
Yeah. Yep. It's don't be a rectangle.
It's a rectangle. For
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, yeah.
That bothers me.
Yeah, that pisses me off.
You're right. She drew it wrong.
Right, you know, even the camera behind him, following him, is like taking it all in. You know, because David Waska, the production designer, did all this fucking work.
They spent a lot of money.
A lot of goddamn money. And so Tarantino's going to be like, he's going to take the camera and just slowly walk through the whole fucking place.
They're going to get their money's worth out of this scene.
Yeah.
Or this set, at least, to some degree. I think this comes back to the dialogue and the moments that they have in this car, though. And even bringing up the point of, like, don't you hate that? Awkward silences. Like, we have to talk, like, and, like, just fill the air with, like, meaningless bullshit just so we can, like, tolerate each other. Like, that kind of... It's a great point to be making. It's a game of telephone and conversation. Did you think of something to say now that she gets back? It's like, I did, but you seem like a nice person, and I don't want to offend you. It's like, no, you can't do that. Okay, fine. And they bring it up, and he says no. It's like, someone would say that Marcellus threw him out that window Jewel said that a couple of guys went and threw him out the window. And then she also claims nobody. And she says, I don't know what you're talking about, but then flips the script again and says, no one knows why Marcellus threw him out that window.
Oh yeah. She does say that. Yeah.
And it's like, so now you're confirming that this is a true thing. And all he did. And the only time he ever touched me was when he shook my hand at my wedding, which we'll see. Her shake Vincent's hand later on. At the end of the night.
All right.
Chew on that.
No, like on top of all that too, it's like that we heard about that story earlier in the script and now we're bringing it back and that's what he's like. It's just beautifully written to bring all that back with Mia. I love their chemistry so much. Like I like when you said the whole thing about don't you hate that when you just can't shut the fuck up for a few minutes? That's when you know you found someone really great.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if we're quite there yet, but we just met, so don't feel bad. I love it. Yep. Like I've taken that like in my own life just to be like, you know, like, we don't have to talk all the fucking time like me and my fiance or like dates before that or whatever.
What are you thinking about?
Yeah.
So what you nothing. Thinking?
We never talk anymore. We're talking right now.
We're literally talking.
About how we never talk.
We just got done talking a lot. Make this year your most awesome yet with a box of awesome from Bespoke Post every month. The Box of Awesome is filled with carefully chosen gear from the best small brands around the world. Let's see what I got this month. This is a travel growler to take with you and two metal cups with it, too, so I can just drink beer on the go.
Dude, I got a freaking coffee maker, like over an open campfire. It's like this thermos that makes freaking coffee. I can be a real man, dude.
There you go. See, I've been doing Bespoke Post for like almost 2 years now. I literally get so excited every single month, like when new month starts, it's the first of the month. I can go in and see what they've curated for me automatically. It's always the coolest stuff from what I end up wanting to pick, right? So whether you want to drink and eat more awesome, dress and travel more awesome, or explore more awesome, Box of Awesome has you covered this year. To get started, take the quiz at boxofawesome.com. Your answers will help them pick the right Box of Awesome for you. It's free to join, and they release new items every month across a ton of different categories. When you become a member, you'll have access to stellar discounts across a plethora of products. We're talking 30% off or more sometimes. Plus, with each Box of Awesome, you're supporting small businesses. 90% of everything that comes in your Box of Awesome is from a small, up-and-coming brand.
That's huge.
It's huge, man. Yeah. So it's free to sign up, and you can skip a month or cancel it at any time. So get a free mystery gift with your first monthly shipment when you sign up at boxofawesome.com and enter the code CONFUSED at checkout. That's boxofawesome.com, code CONFUSED, for a free mystery gift with your first monthly shipment. Boxofawesome.com, code CONFUSED.
I'm always looking for new knives.
Dude.
That observational style of dialogue that Tarantino just sees something cool and like writes it down.
Yeah.
Like the, don't you just love when you come back from the bathroom and your food's waiting for you? That is a universal thing that everyone loves.
We would always say that, like, oh,
if I get up and go to the bathroom now,
then the food will come, right?
Exactly.
I better go.
But no one's ever put that in a movie.
Yeah. No.
And now I think about it every time.
Yes.
Exactly. Every time that happens, you know. Steve Buscemi.
Well, can we consult the Jarrett Layoff
Breakfast Actor
Database? Steve Buscemi's appearance in Pulp Fiction ties him with the number one spot with John Candy.
Wow.
With 8 appearances.
Are you serious?
John Candy now is tied with Steve Buscemi in any movie we've done for the most appearances.
Where's Sam Jackson at?
Sammy Jackson, this is his fifth.
Fifth, wow.
And then you got Bruce Willis at 4, and then it drops off from there. But those are the big ones.
Wow.
Steve Buscemi in this, it's almost like, hey, I want you in my movie, but I don't know where to put you, bro. I'm so sorry. Like,
whatever.
I just happened to see these other people at a party I was at, and I decided to cast them because I was high, you know. And I already made a commitment. I signed it on a napkin. Apparently, that's binding. And here we are. So I've got a part. It's a waiter.
Well, oh. I've got a part. I want you to play Buddy Holly.
Yeah.
Oh.
And he does it.
He pitches him. It's like, you're going to play Buddy Holly.
Oh, that sounds great, Tarantino.
Yeah. And then he gets there. He's like, I am Buddy Holly for 5 seconds as a waiter. I'm not even Buddy Holly. I'm a guy who plays Buddy Holly as a waiter.
Yeah. What the?
Damn it, Quentin.
I am Daryl Marks.
Yeah.
Marxist.
Playing Buddy Holly.
No, he's Mr. Pink.
Yeah.
And hiding out.
Yep.
We all know this.
But we like, know this.
He does play it perfectly too, and it does.
How about you, Betty Sue? Or Peggy Sue?
Yeah. It's great because it's a guy who is there to play Buddy Holly and be work, but he's working.
But he's so working. He's
like, fucking, you want that Amos and Aaron or what?
You want that Martin Lewis or Amos and Andy? Martin and Lewis.
You know that bloody as hell or you know,
bloody as hell or burnt to a crisp.
I don't even fucking care.
Well, he's in the weeds, like he's got five tables and they all got sat at the same time. Oh, yeah. It's like shit.
He's pissed, and because Marilyn Monroe, he's covered for Marilyn Monroe because she's got to go do the dress thing.
She
again.
Does the dress thing every
it's
5 minutes.
It's like, God, every time there's a table turn.
Jane Mansfield didn't show up.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, she should be here. She must not be on tonight. he's covering this whole damn place. How many girls do you think he says, how about you, Peggy Sue?
Yeah. That's his line.
That's his line.
They gave
right?
him the cards. They go, call yeah. the girls this.
Do this.
Use TV shows as racist terms because it's the 50s or whatever. It's fine.
Like, yeah, you know, because that's what we call vanilla or chocolate. Yeah, you know, that's fine. It's fine.
It's not, the 50s or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. We're trying to transport him back through time. Woo! And even with all the racist stuff, too. It's just like, jeez.
So Fox Force 5 pilot.
Ah, yes. Ah.
Sound a little familiar to you guys?
No.
Deadliest girl with a knife on Earth.
Do you think he had this in mind, or he came back to it?
I think he definitely did have it in mind. I think
it was probably just a little thing.
I think the thing is that him and Uma were like talking about it on this set,
and they're like, "What if it was real?"
It's like
well,
oh,
I think
it
they
be
like
a
they
thing.
Had already come up with the idea.
Wow,
I'm pretty sure. And no then kidding. Like he wanted to do Jackie Brown before that.
Yep,
and yeah, and I mean, but it's pretty much the Deadly Viper Assassination Squad from Kill Bill.
Let's say that Tarantino decided to do Kill Bill in, I believe, what's Jackie Brown, 97?
Somewhere around there.
Yeah. Like, did Kill Bill in 97 rather than, like, 2000 or whatever? Like, how do you feel it would have gone? Do you think it would have been really, like, I feel like it could have been crazy different. Because Jackie Brown, they make Jackie Brown feel like an older movie.
Mm-hmm.
He does a great job of doing it that way, like, making it feel like it's a like almost like a 70s flick. But how would you, do you think Kill Bill would have been as good if it was 97?
I don't know. It definitely probably would have been great, but I don't know if it would have been as great because
he needed that palate cleanser of Jackie Brown.
I think so. Like I think it's
everybody
like,
did
almost
kind
like
of.
A movie that he needed to make, and I think he even says himself where he's like, "That's a movie I should have made when I was like my age now." Speaking like now, 2024.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Like that's like a. That's like a later career movie in a director's career, it seems sure. like, you know?
Yeah.
It seems like a little bit more polished, a little bit more mature. It's a love story. And then he fucking does a blood-drenched Kill Bill.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
This dance, every time, the perfect choice of the song, how good they are, their chemistry dancing to this. Like, I'm enthralled every single time I watch them dance. Yeah.
Nope. I want to dance. I want that trophy. Let's go. It's like, okay. And why is it so perfect in the way that they kind of come out here, and she's into it, obviously, and so is he to some degree, but it's the way he starts off. They both take off their shoes, and then it's like, all right.
No emotion.
Yeah.
No emotion.
If I'm about to lift something heavy, that's what I
do.
Yeah.
You know?
All right.
No, you never can do.
And they start... It's like, you know, it's like, all right, shut up and twist. You know what I mean? And it was great. Like, it's just such a, and this is a scene, like, it shouldn't take this long. You know, no, why would you linger on this scene for so long?
Because it's so good.
It is. It's so good for no reason because they linger on it so long to the point that they start rehashing dance moves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then it's like very involved. And then the camera pulls back and it's just like a little bit more of an audience perspective. And it's like, not boring, but it's like, okay, I see what they're kind of doing. I don't know. It's very interesting filmmaking.
It goes to pretty much the bridge of that Chuck Berry song.
It's a long time.
Which is, you know, like maybe 2.5 minutes into that song or something like that. This shouldn't work at all.
Nope.
This dance scene should like throw everyone off. And even like watching it nowadays, it should like I'm wondering what our executive producer thinks. Like, was it corny at all? Like, it could be corny to some people, but I really think their conversation before all this
helps
makes it earn it. Like, you are allowed to do this dancing because that dialogue and that chemistry was so electrifying, and now we're getting a physical representation of it.
But now and even then, now because of that, now you believe their chemistry being drunk and getting home now and how he's concerned that he might do something.
Yeah.
Cause you had to take these steps to get there properly to make, oh, well, these guys might actually really like each other. They might actually get along really well. Do you think, like, had she not done had she not snorted the heroin and been unconscious, do you think she would have tried to keep him there? Do you think he would have successfully been able to leave? Do you think they would have?
It's this chance thing, man, yeah. is what I'm yeah. saying. Because even, like, I think I read something or heard something where you're supposed to store heroin in, like, a balloon. And he didn't have them. So he stored them in a plastic bag where you usually store cocaine.
Yeah.
Had he gotten it in a balloon,
she should have probably known.
Wouldn't have made this mistake.
An experienced druggie might know, you know? And then, and that's the thing, too, where it's like if he wasn't in the bathroom for that long talking to himself, like maybe he would have gone out and she would have taken it out of the pocket when he's there.
Yes.
And he would be like, no, don't fuck with that. I don't know. It's cool. I mean, like, I have to say this too, because I really loved it around this time around. The way he, like, they get inside and music, drinks, and she goes to start to play the song. He's like, I'm going to take a piss. The way he looks at her after saying he needs to take a piss and she's spooling up the song, man, I've had those looks with women before where you're just like, holy shit, this is different.
It's like there's a moment now that it depends on what we do here.
Yeah. And like, I know I'm not supposed to do this. There's that element to it too. But like, there's the look that he gives where it's perfect. I don't know. Do you guys know what I'm saying?
100%.
It's just like you see that girl and you're just like, holy shit. Like, my whole life is going to change now.
There's something different. Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead.
No, that's why then it even means more now that she has overdosed.
Yeah.
And yes, this is, he's a dead man if she dies.
Yeah.
But also, I think he genuinely wants this girl to live.
Sure.
Like, they really want to make this happen, you know?
There is something so dark yet funny about how it cuts back to him in the bathroom and he's kind of had this conversation far enough in with himself already, cuts to her and she's kind of like finds the drugs and it cuts back to him. He's like, you see, this is a test of one's morality. And it's just like, get out of the bathroom.
It's like,
man.
He's like, he was almost finished with the conversation with himself at that point. But he's like, no, I got more to say to you.
Yeah. Like, it's like, he's like, he's really got to tell himself, you need to get out of here.
Go,
like,
home, jerk off. And that's all you,
and that's all you're going to do. And it's like, he's like, you're going to be polite. You're going to have a drink. You're going to leave. And he's like, you know what? If you have a drink, you're going to get in trouble. Like, this, it's going to lead to too much.
What, Mia, like, I got to get going.
Hey, you know, Mia,
like,
so I got to get going.
Yeah.
Oh, God. Oh, no. And, like, that's his reaction is like, oh, God, fuck, no.
And now I do agree with you. There is some of, like, the connection still there, but I think it's mostly, like, she's an object now.
Yeah.
Like, she is Marcellus's now.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and he's got to protect it.
And this is where he shines, man. Like, his aggression-filled, he's like, get the shot!
Oh,
you
know,
or even the fucking black match Marty, black fucking pen,
a felt tip pen,
felt tip fucking pen, black marker.
Lance, I'm a big fucking trouble man.
Lance,
what?
Lance,
fuck,
I'm a big fucking trouble man. It's like that conversation, like where he's like, I got a chick, she's ODing on me, and I'm bringing her to your house. He's like, what? No, don't bring her here.
No, you're not.
Well, then you bite the fucking bullet and you take her to a hospital and call a lawyer. It's nope, no can do.
And then he hears the car speed around the corner.
Are you calling me on a cellular phone? Who is this? I don't know you. Prank phone call.
Do you know you
and want that cut to him when he goes to the door and all that's in one shot too. I know that there's some movie. It's like, obviously he's probably not on the other phone, right? It doesn't matter because he gets off the phone, walks over, and then the car comes through. And it's like, man, that's good.
You know, they wanted John Cusack for Eric Stoltz?
Yeah. Oh,
that would have been good, too.
I love Eric Stoltz in this, but I feel like John Cusack could have really been awesome in this.
Man, that's a rare occurrence that you could recast somebody in this.
If you gave
him the same kind of makeup, obviously, like the longer hair, it just John Cusack colored, and the facial hair. It could have been great.
I get him and John Travolta mixed up all the time, too.
So, like,
that would have been really cool. But, yeah, I mean, like, this is, like, probably the most iconic scene from the movie, right?
This is what you kind of think of, most people think of when you think of this movie.
I mean, just imagine seeing this for the first fucking time.
Sam Jackson.
Yeah.
I mean.
Imagine seeing this for the first time and being like, well, we were having such a good time.
This was actually kind of a fun movie.
This was a lot of fun up until right about now that you're seeing this massive needle come out.
The thump of the needle.
Oh yeah.
Like that like based through my system, and just I mean, that really drives home what is happening, and her waking up from that, and that wide shot of everybody on the ground just looking at her, and she's going, "Oh shit." I mean, like this scene's completely iconic.
It's great. If you're okay, then say something. Something.
Like, and then it's the scene's gone.
The melting away of the anxiety from that shot when she is up and mm-hmm. finally like awake and coherent again, and like Travolta's just on the ground, like it's like the sigh of relief. If I was in a theater, like everyone would, you would be able to hear that resounding.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
God.
And they didn't have to do the go back to the house.
Yeah.
Like I feel like there are some things they could have cut, but I also don't want them to, because I do like this final moment of like the, hey,
because
goodbye.
Because like yeah. what I said before, like she's just kind of an object now. Like he has to save her or else he's going to fucking get killed. You know, there's that aspect to it. But then like once everything's yep. kind of okay and they have that agreement, she's like, do you want to hear my joke? And so it's back now. And yeah.
He loves her again.
Yeah. And so there's, oh yeah, we had a connection before all this, but like it's totally done now.
And she,
like,
looks, you know, she, Uma Thurman looks gorgeous as a person who just OD'd on heroin. Yeah. You're like, I love you. I mean, if you still want to go inside, like,
you want to have that drink.
Yeah, how about that drink?
Uma Thurman, and we don't talk enough about her because she's kind of done in this movie, but no one else could have been Mia Wallace.
Again, it's like a character. Like, she chews the hell out of this character, and it's fucking fantastic. That hair, I have no idea where that comes from, but that is, I mean.
That's what I thought Uma Thurman looked like.
Yeah.
I know, so did I.
And then she's Kill Bill, I'm like, what's up with the blonde wig?
Yeah, I know.
Weird. Dude,
not into blondes.
I'm not into blondes right now. Someday I may be.
It's, dude, I think it's almost like the hair is like a part of the joke in this movie, man. Like, seriously, the hair should not work in this movie. Like, for most of these main characters, it just shouldn't work. And then you're just, for whatever reason, you just get over it very quickly. Yeah, Uma Thurman just has this, like, it's almost like, and it's like a sweet ignorance to her character, but she's a grown up. You know what I mean? I don't know. It's tough to explain. Yeah. I really do like it. And like I say, it's that one moment though, too, that I think when they do shake hands at the end, and that's what she described as why Marcellus threw Rocky out the window. And you're just, it's kind of like, is it like a death kiss almost?
Yeah. All right, so scene three. Before the boxing match, Butch remembers how he obtained his father's gold watch when he was 5 years old. Butch wins the fight after betting bribe money, and he escapes the ring using a cab ride. He prepares to flee with his girlfriend Fabian, but discovers she's forgotten to pack the gold watch. Returning to his apartment to retrieve it, he catches Vincent off guard and kills him. Go ahead.
I mean, True Romance in this movie. Is, I think, I don't know why he hasn't been in another Tarantino movie other than, I guess, these two scripts anyway. He's very good at telling his dialogue, obviously. How is he not in other movies of Tarantino's is what I want to know.
You're talking about Christopher Walken.
Yeah.
I carried this uncomfortable hunk of metal of my ass for 2 years. He'd be damned. It's your birthright. He'd be damned. Those greasy bastards would get their hands on your birthright.
He doesn't fail even being Christopher Walken. Like it's so good. Like the pause.
The pause. Yes.
Yeah. He's like, and now I give the watch to you. It's.
I think it's the greatest monologue incredible. In the history of cinema.
Okay. The pause shouldn't have happened. The pause was a mistake.
Oh, it was.
It was a mistake.
He kind of forgot his line.
He stumbled on it. He kind of forgot his line, and then he. He paused almost like for dramatic effect, and they kept going, and then he picked it right back
up. Dude, that's fucking wild because in that moment, I can see in his eyes the whole thing replaying in his mind, like the whole Hanoi Hell thing.
Yeah.
Like that is fucking crazy.
So did you hear the theory that actually Captain Koons is actually Butch's father?
Mm.
There's a thought that there was not that this was some sort of affair, or like, you know, that she had she was dating Captain Koons, then he went off to war, and that they basically made up the story of him having a dad that died because they just were not going to be together, his mom and Captain Koons. Because think about, he says, I heard a lot about you. Well, like, when did you hear a lot about him? Because Butch is five, his dad died 5 years ago. So like, what has he heard about Butch in the time from then till now? The mom is hearing this story for the first time, and she's just like, like, yeah, your father died a terrible way. She, because there was no father. He knows a lot about the fine details of the watch. He couldn't have like gained that information from the dad and held on to that and remembered everything for 5 years. Mm. They were in a prison. They couldn't talk in prison.
Yeah, it's like a collective 7 years.
Yeah, it's like 7 total years.
Because 5 years he carried it in his ass. And then when he died of dysentery.
There's a lot more to that. But if you think about it, like this is actually, and then maybe there's the thought that he actually finds this out later. He says, my dad went through a lot to get this watch to me. Mm. At the end, he says that. So maybe they finally come clean and Captain Coons is like, actually, I am your dad. Like, you were too young to figure that out. So I just wanted to tell you about your made up dad, but I am. Because my dad went through a lot to get me that watch.
Mm. Right.
Kind of an interesting thought.
See, yeah. And he talks about it too, which obviously comes up later in the scene. There's something that happens between two men when they share and the bonds that they share. When you're in the confines like this for so long, that he just goes on, and then we'll continue on with the scene. I'll just leave it at that.
Yep. he's like, and now, little man, I give now the watch to you. And the kid's just like, okay.
Did you clean it?
The butt watch?
The first thing after this whole thing, literally after it just goes to ding. After that is my wife said, who wants a butt watch?
Which is what we all thought the first time we saw this movie.
And she's like, would you want a butt watch? I was like, whose butt is it? Your butt?
Depends on whose butt it's in, Bennett.
All right, so here I am. It's the middle of March. I'm staring outside my window, and I'm looking at my lawn, which needs work. It's pretty obvious. That's why every single lawn company comes to my house. They drive through my neighborhood. They go, oh, this guy needs help. They knock on my door and they're like, here, pay all this money so we can make your lawn look nice. And I always say yes, because I've spent, just like you, hours in Home Depot fumbling around YouTube to eventually just pay hundreds of thousands of dollars for people to fix my lawn because I don't want to be that guy in the neighborhood. But not this year. I have already told two guys already in the last week. No thanks. I'm using Lawn Bright this year, and you have to do it too with me. It's the best. It's a solution that takes the guesswork out of DIYing your lawn and saves you tons of money. Lawn Bright's custom lawn plan delivers everything you need for a healthy lawn all year long. All their plans start with a soil test, so they build in a plan that delivers the exact nutrients you need. We're talking soil conditioners, fertilizers, seed, weed control, everything you're going to need for the entire year. We love that their products are natural. That is huge. I've got a baby. I've got animals. I don't want those harsh chemicals so that those kids can be on the grass and we don't have to worry about it. We're hanging out, having a picnic. It's better for the earth too. We love that. These products are super easy to use. You hook them up to a hose and they take about 15 minutes to spray on. The company even sends text reminders based on your weather so you apply at the right time. Please join me. These guys are awesome. They're sponsoring this podcast and they're helping us all get a good lawn this spring. We got to start now. So join me. Go to getlawnbright.com and use code confused for 20% off your first order. I've sent in my soil test. My stuff's on the way back and I'm ready to rock and roll this spring to have a great looking lawn without having to do too much myself and without having to pay money. Join us. Getlawnbright.com. Use code confused for 20% off the first order. Here we go. But this watch scene is so goddamn important because not only is it one of the best monologues in history, and it's such a funny, weird story.
Strange story.
If we don't get this story about the watch, none of the rest of the stuff happens because that watch has to be important. Mm. It has to be so important that he's willing to risk his life for it.
Yeah.
Because if that's anything else, like I'm like, Molly, we got to bug out of town. She's like, oh, I left your whoop at home. Like, cool.
That's fine.
I wanted you to bring it because I like the data that it gives me, but like, I'll get another one.
Yeah. Right.
He has to go back to get this watch. And it sets up the whole rest of this. Nothing else happens without this. He leaves town and they're done.
Right. Fourth generation, like, watch in his possession. He wants this watch.
They're out.
And it is that moment that he realizes, like, where's my watch? Now, all this other shit doesn't matter. Where's my watch?
Yeah.
You know, and that fit he ends up like going through is I think it's kind of peak Bruce Willis in this.
Yeah.
But before we get there, obviously this is before the fight, or we have the fight that happened.
Yep.
And the cab ride, the background of the cab, again, guys, this is talk about pulp fiction, rough around the edges, like filmmaking, rough paper, whatever you want to call it. That background of that cab is peak. And for some reason, I love it. It's not even that I don't care. It's that I love that it's that way.
It's, you know, almost every other scene in this movie is like just real, like the car's on a trailer, you know?
Yeah.
But this was all shot on a studio, obviously. It's the rear projection.
Yeah.
Purposely bad.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like you could, it's like maybe not even bad, but just like a choice. Just a choice to just be like, well, this is a fantasy.
And
you
it's
know,
kinda,
doesn't it make it feel like noir almost? Like it makes it feel like, ooh.
It is a noir thing.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
like a noir story. Like this is, you know, where MacGuffin comes from. The gold watch is a MacGuffin. The fucking briefcase is a MacGuffin, you know.
Yeah.
It's taking everything from all that kind of shit. Yeah.
And it just makes it, again, I take it back to, it seems like a story being told,
mm-hmm.
you know. It's like a recollection type of a story being told is the way it makes it feel to me, or like comic booky and kind of. Yeah, fantastical.
If I am getting rid of anything in this movie, though, I feel like this is where the movie takes a slow turn. The cab ride for me is kind of like, sort of like I always feel kind of weird. Like, why?
Is
this girl here? And like, why is she all fascinated with the death? And
what's it like to kill
him?
Hey, what's it like to? Will you leave me the fuck alone?
Yes.
Yeah, it's like, I'm sorry. When I requested this Uber, I said, please, no conversation. Yeah. And I wanted it to be cooler in here, too. I got
but you are letting me smoke, so
yeah,
that's pretty cool.
It's like, and I'm not wearing a mask. It's one of those things like, please stop talking to me. Like, I can't, I don't get what the value of this cab conversation brings.
We do learn a little bit more about Bruce. We get to know him a little bit better.
Okay.
He gets to explain some things, but... But I feel like then we also get into that with Fabian too. Like
you learn he killed Floyd, and so there's like, even if maybe he didn't kill him, even if he did rip Marcellus off, he's going to kill Butch because he killed one of his guys.
Yes.
Yeah.
So there's that.
That has to be, because obviously we see Marcellus is in Floyd's dressing room, and that's mm-hmm. like what he did. He ended up doing, and so he must have had a connection to Marcellus. Yeah.
And then we get to understand that he took the bribe money. And then threw it a bet on himself,
yeah.
like on like eight different bookies or something like that. So he's got to have some major money coming his way.
And he leaked the fix.
Yep.
Yeah.
Do we like Fabian? Do we like this whole scene with her?
Like, yeah, I do. I used to not at all.
I agree with you.
I do like their conversation. It's really like kind of sweet. And it's like young love. It's like they just kind of got together maybe a few months earlier, you know?
Do they allude to the fact that she's like a not a hooker, but like a stripper or something like that? Like, I feel like at some point he like in one of his like rants, he just ends up saying something like that.
I don't think so.
No. Okay. I felt like there was something in there, and like he's kind of infatuated with this girl, and that's the way it does seem. It seems like a very new love and relationship.
He's clearly has some feelings for her, because I love the way they play out that fight, because this is real world fighting when you care about somebody,
yes.
where you get so mad because of how important this was and how fucking stupid you are to forget that. But I really need to apologize. I love you. I'm so sorry. Yeah, I'm so sorry. But then, you know, he loves her, but he's now cold to her. He's like, here's some money. You know, go get breakfast. I'll be back.
Have fun with your fucking breakfast. Yeah.
Cause I have to go do this. He knows that there's a 90% chance he's going to die now.
Yeah.
But then he gets back.
As soon as he is alone, he's like,
motherfucking son of a. That's when I think it happens that he makes mention of her whatever her prior work was.
I don't know.
Anyways, I'll listen back. But anyways, yeah. Motherfucker.
It's just the most accurate depiction of a fight with a loved one I've ever seen.
I'm going for a fucking drive.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I'm just going to go for a drive.
I'm
sorry. As soon as I get in the garage.
God damn it. Fucking watch.
Okay, so, but seriously though, like, that is really fucked up. She forgot the watch. But if it's that fucking important, bring it with you to the goddamn fight.
Maybe tell her the story.
Tell her the story,
and this is how important
tell
it is.
Her the story. If you're going to bestow the responsibility onto somebody else, then
why weren't
go
you wearing
this?
It to your fight, and then you take it off and you put it in your bag?
There's it.
Weird.
Yeah, super strange. I know.
It needed to happen, though, because
I was even going to say maybe punchable face Fabian because of this, but I'm like, you know, it's not totally her fault at all. No,
I think it is.
Oh, you want to do it?
I think it's worth just even her haircut.
If we were on a train to go punch a face,
I want a pot. You want some? You're looking in the mirror and you say you want some pot? I'm sorry. I'm so CTE. Right
I'm
now.
Sorry. I'm pretty punchy.
You're punching her just because of her haircut?
I think it's because of her haircut and the way that she says, describes her breakfast. That's another thing.
Blueberry pie with a thin slice of cheese on it.
Yeah.
That's gross.
I think, you know what? Don't ever describe that to me again.
All right. You got punchable a punchable face. It's tough in this one.
I guess Maynard.
Maynard.
Yeah, Maynard. Zed.
Zed. It's Maynard.
Maynard. I'm punching the dude on the couch from earlier. The one that's like, no, chill, man. It's cool.
Flock of Seagulls?
Flock of Seagulls. I'm punching Flock of Seagulls for sure.
No, the one by your knees.
One by your knees. You have a cold? Like what?
This very much though is like one of the coolest moments though is when he goes back to the apartment.
Yeah. And you can hear too like all of like the radio chatter and stuff. That's super cool. It's just super immersive, but
reminds
also like
me of a video game.
Yeah, exactly. It's very intense. Like I remember when I first saw this movie, I'm like, fuck, what's going to happen? Are they going to be there? You know? And then he gets up there and, you know.
Well, I always wondered like, how did the toaster and the Pop-Tarts not wake up or like alert Vincent in the bathroom?
My thing is, I think because later in this next scene, he does run into Marcellus and he's getting coffee and donuts. I think that him and Vincent are like, having a day.
100%.
He thought it was
Marcellus coming back.
Yeah. And so he thinks he's just Marcellus reading his fucking whatever French novel he's got. And he's like, oh, I guess he's just rummaging through shit out there. Okay, whatever. I'm finish my shit.
Like you say, like after this whole thing, you know, hey, you took care of me. I really appreciate it and stuff. And hey.
And Jules left. Jules doesn't work here anymore.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You need a partner real quick.
And
this is pretty personal to him.
Yeah, yep, very personal. So
I want to finish the job. Yeah. I'm bringing this big ass gun.
Why else would he be walking through this neighborhood when we see where he lives? Yep. You know,
I think that's a fantastic way to look.
And there's a big thing about how reckless Vincent is with firearms too. Yep.
Yeah,
and that even though this is more than likely probably Marcellus's gun.
Yeah, 100%, in that theory, Marcellus couldn't take it with him. It's too big.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
So he had to just leave it.
He's not going down to Duncan with a Mac 10 super silenced.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's the whole thing too of like if he shows up 10 minutes earlier, 10 minutes later, he's a dead man.
Yep.
But it just so happened to be when Marcellus was gone and while he was taking a constipated heroin shit.
The perfect chance encounter.
Boom.
It's crazy. Like all through this movie, this is what happens.
Can I get prop?
Yeah, you want prop?
Prop.
Ooh, here's a prop.
I want the book that Vincent is reading on in the bathroom every time.
Because you want to just see what the hubbub is about.
Yeah, like why is he spending so much time reading this book and getting literally everyone, including himself, into serious trouble?
Yep.
I want to know.
I mean, I want the ceramic kangaroo.
Good call.
That holds the watch. I mean, like, I want that on a shelf.
Nobody wants the watch with it.
No, poop watch. I want just the kangaroo.
I mean, the watch would be the one. That's the one. The way to go.
What about the USC Santa Cruz banana slugs t-shirt? Yeah, I think you could wear that pretty well.
That's a good one.
What about the samurai sword?
That's a good one, too.
What about the chainsaw?
That's a good one.
What about the axe? What about, sorry.
I'm going to go watch.
You're going watch.
Yeah, all right, then we can put our props together.
Yeah, there we go.
Cool, man.
Nice.
Yeah. Teamwork.
Well, let's move on to scene four. So when Marcellus spots Bush stopped at a traffic light, they fight in the street and fall into a pawn shop where they're knocked unconscious by the owner. Now gagged and with a man named Zed and a gimp in the room, Marcellus is taken into another room and abused. Butch escapes but decides to return to save Marcellus, who gratefully lets Butch leave with Fabian, never to return. Before he sees Marcellus, I think this is my favorite moment of the movie when Bruce Willis gets in the car and realizes he's free.
He's home free.
And he does that smile. And he turns and goes, and he just drives away in that shitty little car. I've rewound that multiple times at how happy Butch is to have actually pulled that out. He thought he was going to die. He thought there's no chance he actually pulls this off. He's going to do it.
You got to think, like, this guy is a like, now a double murderer.
Yep.
Yeah.
You know, and this is a crazy thing, to, like, thinking about sequencing and whatnot and having these stories out of sync, really, all happening in the time frame of a couple of days. Like, you know, we talk about this. Vincent has been in every single one. Technically, by the end of this, in the actual chronological timeline, Vincent is killed, mm-hmm. and he's dead. And it's kind of sad to think mm-hmm. about. Like, it would be a hard way to finish this movie.
This would have been the final scene, them riding off on the motorcycle. Yep.
Right.
Or, like, eventually would have been
that's
the final scene.
That's pretty much
right?
the end of the story.
Yeah. Right, yeah. right. And it's such a strange thing. But him doing that to Vincent, and then we're just like, oh, my gosh. And then he's like, huh. And he gets in his car, and he's just kind of stoked about it.
I keyed his car, now I killed him. It's a fucking great day.
And it's like, it's casting, too, right? Because everyone loves John Travolta. Everyone loves Bruce Willis at this point, too, where it's just like, oh, fuck. John Travolta's gone out of the movie? Like, not seeing
don't
it
worry,
yet.
we'll cleanse that palate right now. Because we're going to throw some real fucked up shit your way.
Yeah, exactly. Don't worry about that.
Don't worry. You'll forget all about, and I think you do forget about Vincent at this point because of what happens now.
Definitely.
That's
a good point.
This whole thing, man, like, this used to really fuck me up, this whole scene. Because, first of all, like, thinking about this gimp.
Gimp is a weird thing.
Like, permanently locked in this box to where this gimp is just whatever.
Yep.
And, like, the fact that it's all happening behind them and they don't know what the mm-hmm. fuck's going on behind them, they're hearing locks opening and boxes opening and then chains rattling. Like, fuck. And then even fucking Zed, like, he's purposely changing his little counting game because he's made up his mind who he wants to fuck in the middle of this game.
God, yeah. Because that's the whole thing about that any mini miny mo. You can manipulate it to how you want it to go.
We used to do it all the time. It depended, like, on the one you started on.
Yeah, it depends on that. And if you land on the one that you are not, it's like, and then you can say, and
he just goes, and
my
you
mother
are
told
it.
Me to pick the very best one, and because you can kind of continue it on.
Yes, I hated it.
And then
the camera shifts to him a little
shifts
bit.
Shifts over.
I love it.
Maine, Spider caught a couple of flies.
Did you read that they're supposed to be brothers in the screenplay? Zed and Maynard?
Oh, really? Oh, my gosh.
Okay, petition right now to go back in time and cast Patrick Labatteau as Maynard.
I like that.
Yeah, I think they would make a...
Nah, he's not hateable enough. Like,
I want to see him in a gritty role.
See, he could do it. He could do it.
Oh, yeah, that's what I'm saying.
But I like him more as the, like... Yeah, whatever.
Yeah.
I think those two would be a pretty good, like, brother combo.
Yep.
You know what I mean? Yeah. I think they would.
The guy from The Mask and Patrick Labatteau.
That guy plays such a hateable guy in every role he's in.
Or what about, like, what can we get a brothers movie of Zed and him, and then, like,
Zed
Peter
Mater?
Peter Weller will be the other
dude,
guy?
Yes.
How about that? They'll be twins.
I got confused.
Yeah.
Like, a little bit.
In some moments he looks like Peter Weller. I love when he's got the gimp right there. He's like tapping on his head. It's so fucking fucked up.
It's so messed.
What is the gimp supposed to do? Like, this doesn't make sense that they're like, he's like, watch this guy.
I think it's their friend that they just, like, because he says Russell's old room.
Yeah.
Let's go do him in there. Yeah, is that Russell one? If it is, they just fucked him so much where he's just, like, brainwashed full of fuck.
And he's just there to intimidate Butch. Like, he's in there to intimidate Butch.
Yeah.
And just make him scared of what's happening.
I think they just deprived him of all humanity. Like, literally. Like, we have to imagine that because he's, like, all dressed in that thing, obviously. And he's also kind of, like, laughing and toying with Butch.
Yeah.
He's like...
There's some sort of make or mention. I don't know if it was in the actual script or if this was a later commentary. And I think it was from Tarantino himself, but that he pretty much just said, like, yeah, he likes to think it was like a hitchhiker or somebody that like got picked up by Maynard and or Zed, and then they pretty much tortured him into the point of like full submission. Yeah.
Very toolbox murders-esque.
Yeah. Like, just very strange situation.
Are you guys going back to help?
Yeah. I when I first watched this movie, I remember the moment I was watching it with my friend Jordan, sponsor us, Jordan.
I think he is.
I was watching
Thanks, dude. Thank you, Jordan.
And we both were like, go back, like talking at the screen, like, go back.
This guy, when
he turns around, I'm like, oh, yes.
But this guy wants to kill you on multiple accounts.
Yeah.
He's the most powerful man you know, and he hates your guts. And you now have bad information about him. Like, it's you. If you have to try to think about it realistically, like, he could have just left.
It could have been scot-free, probably.
Yeah. This goes back to the beginning and hearing the story. It's like there's a bond that happens between two men in this captivity where you kind of owe it to each other to take on certain responsibilities.
Thank you. Because he gets told the whole story about his dad.
Yep. Yeah.
And now he's kind of going through the same thing.
Samurai sword too.
Samurai sword, dude.
Been watching a lot of Shogun lately, guys.
There you go.
Samurai is all about honor.
You heard about that earlier this week on our What Are We Watching
episode. You betcha.
I almost like thinking to myself, I don't know if this is a fan theory anywhere that you have, but if the watch is cursed. Because what if the watch like needs trauma? And like you haven't, like Butch hasn't earned it yet, even though he's a fighter, he's, you know, fighting. But what if it's like this weird like trauma machine where trauma MacGuffin even where you just the handler of it, the owner of it needs to go through some sort of fucked up experience like this. And so this is happening to him now. He like it's chance he walked into this pawn shop and no other shop or no other door
at this
that was
time.
Open. Yeah.
No one else was in there.
Exactly. I don't know. It's kind of fun to think about.
I love that. I think this watch is just it's addicted to ass trauma. You're right.
Oh my God. Get out of here, man.
I need to be in an ass. I need to see some ass.
I need
ass.
To see some ass. I need to just experience, you know.
Hey, Zed, can you shove me in there?
Hey, when's my turn? That's the watch, not Maynard.
Do you also kind of like to think that, like, when Fabian forgot the watch, like, she's like, secretly being like, oh, yeah, I forgot. I did forget, but I was kind of thinking, like, maybe it was time to let that go.
Maybe.
You know? You know, like maybe let you know you don't need an ass watch
maybe.
Anymore.
I was kind of thinking about it, and I realized like I didn't really want to touch the ass watch.
You told that story to my parents last week when they were visiting for dinner, and they were really weirded out by that.
The first time you met them, it's just like
that's the first thing you told my dad. You said you have a watch that was in my dad's ass.
I feel like all I can think about is every time we meet somebody new, you tell this story about this ass watch. And how it got to you, and I'm kind of tired of hearing about it.
Watch, yeah.
If anything,
listen, I think it's time. Time.
No,
I think it's time to let it go, honey.
I'm pretty fucking far from okay.
I love his
step
line.
Aside, Butch.
This pumps me up more than anything.
Yeah.
Knowing what's gonna happen to Zed.
Yeah.
But like, still not being able to see
you. Hear
like,
me, hillbilly boy. I ain't through with you by damn
by
sight.
By damn sight.
And like it's the so like good. The he's like. You best be getting on your way.
Yeah.
The
yeah.
door closes. Well, you notice too, Bruce Willis understands that he went back to save him, but he's not fully out of danger.
Oh,
because he doesn't know what Marcellus is going to do at this point. So he's still got his sword in like attack position.
Yeah.
Oh, that what now?
Yeah. What now? And then he's like, as far as that, there is no me and you. And then he like lowers the sword.
You lost all your LA privileges.
Yeah. Fine with me. I was leaving anyway.
Yeah.
I want a sequel where we get to see what Marcellus and his boys do to this guy.
Oh, gosh, yeah. Like
pair of pliers and a blowtorch.
Yeah.
Get medieval on your ass. What a badass.
It's so cool. It's great.
Yeah. It's a pretty solid redemption.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, let's get to the final scene. So flashing back to Vincent and Jules in the apartment, another man jumps out and tries to kill them. He's killed by the two hitmen. The informant Marvin is taken with him, but accidentally shot in the car. They hide the car at the home of Jules' friend Jimmy while Mr. Wolf helps him clean up the situation. At a diner afterwards, Jules tells Vincent his plans to leave the lifestyle just as the couple from the beginning begin their dinner heist. Jules saves the day by defusing the situation. They both leave the diner.
What happened here was a fucking miracle, and I want you to fucking acknowledge it.
Okay, I acknowledge it.
What's all divided right. and original? You mean like God came down and stopped the bullets? That's exactly what I meant. Yeah.
Did you see the size of that thing? Goddamn, bigger than him.
Goddamn hand cannon.
Did you just forget to tell us that there was somebody hiding in the bathroom with a goddamn hand cannon?
Alexis Arquette in this, like it's crazy to see her in this, what would you, how do you say it?
Yeah.
And her as, yeah. as a man now. Yeah. But, like, I think she's great. Yeah. Like cutting back to this perspective also to get us back into a scene that we've already seen.
Yeah.
It's really cool. And, yeah, I think it's like just super fucking funny.
Well, it's
like
interesting to call it a,
six bullets and just none of
hit
them
hit nothing. And this is another scene that, my brother had described to me in detail, and it was that moment of them after that he just comes out shooting and just die, and nothing, and they just look at each other. And they like I remember it as vividly like him telling it to me as I do like remember watching the scene now. And it's such an interesting thing. And the bullets behind Jules, the bullet holes behind Jules is like a, it's kind of a, it's apparently kind of a point of contention for viewers.
Yeah.
Because some people are saying they're already there and some people are saying that they weren't. And
they were and they weren't.
They yeah. definitely were. Yeah.
Do you think Vincent killed Marvin on purpose?
I don't think so. Mm. I think he's just reckless with firearms, man. He doesn't put the safeties on. He just puts it into his
pants.
He's got
his finger on the trigger.
He's got his finger on the trigger all the time.
He's kind of an oopsie poopsie through this whole movie.
He kind of is, man.
Poopsie.
Well, I mean, Vincent is 100% not a good hitman. I mean, he sucks at his job. Everything, like, it tends to be kind of his fault, right? Something bad happens every time Vincent goes to the fucking bathroom.
Yeah.
Something bad happens. There's a thought out there that Marcellus doesn't really he likes him a lot. That's why he sent him to Amsterdam. He's like, you're not good. You're addicted to heroin, but I like you. I like your crazy fucking brother, Vic Vega, is going to kill me if I don't give you this job. So they send him to Amsterdam. He comes back, but Marcellus keeps giving him jobs that are not hard. But he keeps fucking him up. So job one, all he has to do is go with Jules, who's a completely confident hitman. And like, all he has to do is kill these three men. Instead, he fucks it up and Jules does all the work. He ends up killing Marvin on accident. Yeah. Job two, all he has to do is take his wife to dinner while he's out of town. He just has to drive her to dinner and babysit her. He gets her. She almost dies. Job three, all he has to do is wait in Butch's apartment just in case he shows up, which he's not going to because he's not an idiot. So there's no way Butch is coming back. So just chill out in this apartment just in case.
Whatever.
It's almost like
to come back and he gets himself killed. Can we get like a recut of, it's like a Looney Tunes recut of Vincent, and it's just got cartoon sound effects to everything that's going
on. I know what's happening.
It's almost like Ryan Gosling in The Nice Guys.
Oh
like
my gosh,
just can't
dude,
do anything
you.
Right, but he's like also, it's also like not a lot of it's his fault. Bad shit just happens around this guy,
and it's
not his fault at all. But like with Vincent, it's like even like going to the bathroom, like I'm gonna go take a shit. The place gets fucking held up, you know.
Yeah,
every
like,
time he's
exactly.
on the toilet,
I almost feel bad for him.
He's in the bathroom when Mia overdoses. He's in the bathroom when the place gets shot up. He's in the bathroom when Butch comes in.
When Butch comes back, he's reading that book. It's like he literally, like, if he would just stop doing heroin, he'd stop being constipated.
That's,
and then
exactly.
and he'd stay out of the bathroom. And even then, it's like, dude, you need to chill out. Like, and obviously it's a little bit different bathroom situation, but it's just like, goddamn, man. It's like, what are you doing to his towels? it's like, what? I'm trying to use soap, but it's just, this stuff's hard to get off. He's like, he had lava. It's like, I had the same soap you did.
Fucking that, just the line, oh man, I shot Marvin in the face.
it's just so nonchalant.
It's just nothing kind of.
And that's the vibe
like,
of.
Add maybe, a laugh track behind that, right?
That's the thought that maybe he did it on purpose, though, is because like Marvin did seriously almost fuck them up by not telling them that there was a guy.
Yeah.
And he looked legitimately really sad that those guys got killed,
like traumatized.
And like Vincent goes right over and he's like, when were you going to tell me there was a guy? You know, like, I don't know. I think almost Vincent's like, fuck this guy.
Vincent's
like, I'm going to pretend like oops.
Oh, man, I shot Marvin in the face.
Dude, when he's on the phone with Jimmy, there's just like brains hanging from him.
Dude, I know. Gross.
That's my problem. I want the brains.
The brains from
Jules. Marvin's brains.
So good.
This moment, like when they get to Jimmy, he's like, this is some gourmet. Instant coffee. He's like, cut the crap, Jules.
Not
okay.
Crap,
he's like, have you guys seen the SpongeBob cut of this?
No.
They have a cut of SpongeBob as Jimmy, and then you have Squidward and Patrick is Jules. And it's like, if they basically line it up perfectly, that SpongeBob's like, it's like, cut the crap, okay? I know how good the fucking coffee is.
Somebody like, goes to the store to buy shit.
He's like, she buys shit, okay? I'm with the good stuff. It's like, but the concern isn't the fucking coffee in my cup right now. It's the dead guy in my garage. It's just like, hey, man, don't even worry. Don't tell me to move on, Jules, okay?
I love how much power he has over them. Like, yeah. He must have some major power in this whole thing.
It's really funny, too. Like, just to be like, your morning interrupted by a dead guy arriving.
This is like 8 a.m., something like that, 8:30.
Yeah, it's really early.
And like disrupting this, and it makes me think, because Jules said it's somebody that he has worked with.
Yeah.
And so it makes you think.
My partner in Toluca Lake.
Yeah, my partner in Toluca Lake. And so he's got to be...
He's connected.
He's connected in this, right? So it's just...
The wolf says, your uncle, Marcellus.
Your uncle, Marcellus. So it's like... But that's the thing. Is like, it seems like he doesn't know Marcellus.
Right.
So it's very... It's a strange thing. I don't know.
It's fantastic, though. Like, as much as I want to hate Tarantino's acting so much, like, I can't.
Yeah.
It's just... It's so Tarantino, and it's just so, like, awesome. Thank you. Thank you for doing this awesome role.
Yeah,
I think because no one else probably would have done that.
Like
role.
The only thing that ages is the N-word stuff, and it's just what Tarantino is. Like it's hard to like see him do it because everyone hates him for doing it so much, you know. Yeah,
and so he's the only one. He's like, I'm not going to tell anybody else to do this, so I'm just going to do it.
Yeah,
yeah. It is kind of one of those things, like, you know, not telling somebody, not directing somebody to do what you wouldn't do yourself. So it is kind of in that same vein of mentality, but at the same time, too, I think he does pick very good like characters and cameos for himself in a lot of his movies that tend to play out very, very well. Same thing as Mr. Brown, in Reservoir Dogs, and I think he picks out these good dialogue moments that. But they aren't show stealers for somebody else to be able to play that role.
Yeah,
because I think he was actually debating on playing Lance too. Yeah. But he was like, I want to be able to direct these types of scenes, you know. And so I think he does that very well. And his interactions, especially, you get another great feature of Harvey Keitel coming through. You're 30 minutes away. I'll be there in 10. there's just something so wonderful about these characters that just drop on by.
I love how he just takes control of this whole situation. Now you got a body in the car in the garage. Take me to it. You know?
He's taking the notes on the phone. Yeah. Jules, black. Vincent, white.
Body minus head.
Yeah. I smelled some delicious coffee in there. He's like, would you mind get me a cup? Oh, sure. How do you take it? Lots of coffee or lots of sugar, lots of cream. It's like, okay, he comes back. And like the little like notice of like...
Just a head nod.
So anyways.
Dude, and like too, where he's arguing with Marcellus to send someone to help them out.
Yeah.
It seems like him and Marcellus like have this good history. Yeah. Like him, like they are real good friends.
Very mutual understanding.
But then he's like, oh, well, I'm going to send the wolf. He's like, you saying the wolf?
Go back in there, chill those guys out.
Yeah, my guy. That's all you had to say.
And wait for the wolf to arrive.
It's like the words, just the wolf is just like, you almost didn't even need to see Harvey Keitel as the wolf do anything. Just knowing
that someone named the wolf is coming,
and that Jules is taken aback by like, oh shit, we're fine.
Oh yeah.
You know? Okay. All right. Sounds good. Yeah. You know, it's a great kind of cap off to this. You know, this horrible scenario that they're this predicament that they're in. I love how Vincent just still can't get over himself at this point. And I like that they finally basically end up in these ridiculous clothes and they make it to the diner.
But that's what's so genius. I want to talk shit about like, well, dude, you don't need the out of order. Just make the movie the order it is. But the more I think about it, ending on this diner scene and Vincent's still alive. And like they're good, and Jules had his moment. Like they're still buddies, and they're gonna leave together. Like I almost love that it ends on this more than if it would have ended on him on the motorcycle.
Yeah, it's hard to consider this like a flashback. If it feels like
the beginning of the movie was like we're setting something up. We'll come back to it later. Yeah. Like, right. That's almost more what it feels like.
Yeah, 100%. There is something about this whole scene about them strolling out at the end.
With the stopping to put the gun
and
in
they,
there.
And they both like are walking in stride. They stop, put the gun away, and then they walk out together kind of with a little bit of a pep in their step.
It's like a happy ending.
Yeah.
and of it, a very not happy movie for the most part.
If we would have ended with Vince dying, like, it would have really put a damper on the whole thing.
Yeah.
You know,
and of all the diners they pick this one.
Yeah.
Just like the chance thing too. And like, do you guys have any thoughts on like the theology in this movie where, you know, Jules is all about like, this was a miracle. I'm going to walk the earth now. Like Kane and Kung Fu. Do you guys have any thoughts about that?
I think it's very easy to look at something as this happened on purpose. There was a reason for this. Everything happens for a reason. I think that is one of the easiest outs in life. And it's the most comforting thing to be like, everything happens for a reason, dude. Because whatever happened, that's the path you're on now. And you have no clue what would have happened elsewhere. If you go back, I actually just traced this back because you inspired me earlier. You said that if they go into that room with the three white guys 5 minutes early, if they don't wait to be on time, let's say they go in early, the guy is not in the bathroom anymore. So they don't get shot at, which means Jules does not feel like he had a divine intervention, which means he doesn't quit, which means he's the one that also goes with Vincent to Butch's apartment, which means he doesn't let his guard down, which means they kill Butch and Vincent lives and they continue on with their mission from one little fucking like decision that he made.
Yeah.
But they don't know that. Jules thinks it was a divine intervention that they survived that, but because of that, Vincent gets killed.
Yeah.
So that's not divine intervention.
I think you're 100% right. And I reiterating on the point of this movie where it's, I think it's really just about these weird chances in life, you know. And that's probably why this movie is structured like this, because it's, you know, this thing seems out of order, and it is out of order, but so is, I guess, everyday life. And like, you know, like with whatever, I decided to take a different way to the studio today. What the fuck could have happened? Like, I could have hit a dog or some shit. It would have been the end of my life. You know, like that, the little menial chances that you don't take. And then the banality of evil as well, too, where like Jules is battling this whole thing in his mind, especially after this divine intervention thing where he spares Pumpkin. Right, Pumpkin.
Yeah, whatever.
Or what is he
pumpkin
called?
Pie.
Ringo. He calls Ringo. Him Ringo.
He's like British invasion.
Yeah, there you go.
See what I'm saying?
Oh my god! I hate
it out there.
Shit,
it keeps going.
But it's fascinating. It's great. I really am glad that you guys kind of took that from it as well, because I watch it for the first time for a long time, and I'm like, I don't know if this has a point to it other than it being fucking awesome.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you look deep enough, it really does.
Yeah.
There's something to be said about, like, it's almost like some sort of sacrifice for the greater good or something. Like, somebody had to die so other people could have this, like, redemption or saving.
Yeah.
You know, sure. like Butch was saved at this point, you know?
Yeah. And Vincent was damned at this point.
Jules was saved at this point. Marcellus saved at this point, like Mia saved, you know. Vincent, technically, after everything is said and done, Vincent really is the one who deserves the damning so others can be saved.
Yeah.
Wow.
You really have to consider it, because a lot, like you said it earlier, a lot of the bad things are happening strictly because of Vincent. Now,
I don't want to be around anymore.
The good things... The good things happened, or this whole thing took place, though, because Jules put into place, let's not go in there yet.
Yep. That's mind-blowing to me that's a thing. I never considered that till today.
Yeah.
So strange, man.
Cool.
Well, boys, we don't want to make the longest episode ever, but I still think we hit him with some bombs. So we got to go modern-day rating on this. We're going to start with Sean on this. I know what he's going to say, but I want to hear him say it.
Yeah, what's your modern day rating, buddy? It just keeps evolving over the years, and every time you watch it. And I really think, like, I watched this movie like four or five times for this review, and I did not get old. I didn't get tired of it whatsoever. I really think that it has, like, if you don't really connect with one of the stories, you can connect with the other. Or, like, you know, this time around, I felt myself like more loving Vincent and Mia's storyline way more than anything else. Than I had previous watches, when I just like kind of fast forwarded to the violent scenes and like or this scene or like the, you know, resuscitation scene. I think the performances are phenomenal. I think it's Sam Jackson's best movie. There's no doubt in my mind why people think that this is Quentin Tarantino's best movie of all time. I won't argue that whatsoever. It's just, you know, apples and oranges for me. I'm not going to change it all. It's a 10. It's a perfect movie. It's fucking Pulp Fiction, dude. I don't know what else to say.
Yep. Yeah. AJ, what about you, man?
This is one of those movies that I probably have no business like enjoying it as much as I do, but it's just right up there with like the thing. Right now, I had quite the aversion to the thing, but it's one that now I want to rewatch and will probably become a fall movie, winter movie for me for a long time. Pulp Fiction is this movie that I think I can rewatch time and time again and continue to think about, and you know, perfect to get your mind off of other things. It's like, I just need to think about this movie for a little while and rabbit hole on this movie for a little while. The casting is amazing. The characters are genuine characters. The outfits and the costuming and the makeup, and everything. It has this hint of like fantastical element, if you will, that it's like the movie's grounded, but this just elevates it a little bit enough, you know, to make it like levitate like David Blaine. You know what I mean? That you're just like, okay, all right. A little bit strange.
We're having fun. I can see that.
Okay. I kind of see what you're doing here though, but it's Quentin Tarantino and it's Pulp Fiction. I mean, how do you argue with this? I am probably going to have to do this, guys. This is a 9.7.
9.7.
What takes it down? 3? Yeah, takes it down? 3.
There's some just not willing to give it a 10. And you are much like me. Like I have a hard time saying that it is like the most perfect movie ever. This was my most favorite watch that I've had of this movie so far. Like thinking about it the way we think about it and then talking about it. And I hope that's what you guys listening take from this, is that it's so fun to just like hear conversations about good movies. And hearing you guys talk about it made this my favorite watch. But ultimately, like I always go back and look at my list, and like my number one so far that we've done is Back to the Future. And there are just a few things that keep it from beating that for me. It's a little bit of a drag down in the middle with Fabian and the cab driver, and it's some of the mistakes, kind of like the bullet holes or the changing of the Honey Bunny saying the things. But like we're talking like utter minuscule stuff. I'm moving this into my 2 spot. This is a 9.4.
Ooh, fuck yeah.
9.4. So Michael Giuliano, who had never seen this, says, "This movie's been a big blind spot in my collection for many years, so I was finally excited to get down to watching it. At this point, I think I've seen so many references and homages to the movie in other things, I felt like I already knew everything that was going to happen. But I found myself surprised by how much I liked it. It's one of the rare movies that holds up to all the hype. Tarantino writes masterful dialogue better than almost anyone in the industry, although I will say that the word choice that he gave his own character in the movie was interesting, to say the least. Probably could have done without that. Harvey Keitel steals the movie for all 20 minutes that he's in it, although the entire ensemble cast can be praised for putting in a great effort. Although if anyone is a Wedding Singer fan, the shooter who comes out of the bathroom to get Jules and Vincent is the same person who plays George, which took me like 3 times to recognize.
Yes, overall,
this is a very good movie that helped popularize a bunch of film techniques that we take for granted now and helped launch Tarantino's career while revitalizing the careers of actors like Travolta and Willis. My modern day rating is going to be an 8.5.
Wow.
Guys, that's a 9.4 for us on the grand scale of things. That falls into number 2, right behind Dazed and Confused. Dazed and Confused is still at number 1 at a 9.5. This is a 9.4. Saving Private Ryan, 9.33. Goodfellas, 9.27. Breakfast Club, 9.26.
Michael, you had an opportunity to bust this into number 1.
I don't know. That's tough. How do you compare those two movies? Sean doesn't care. He's happy.
No,
right?
I mean, hey.
This is like, now our number 2 rated movie.
Literally, it is like I can see what you're saying about those little flaws that you have, but yeah, like to me it is, there's nothing wrong with it. Like I go back to our RoboCop review, and it's like literally that last shot of the guy falling out of the fucking skyscraper is the only thing wrong with that. There's nothing
wrong.
And
it is
here.
A problem.
it takes you out of it. But yeah.
Well, we hope you enjoyed the episode. Thanks for being here. Tune in next week. We discuss the movie Election, followed up by a new movie that is out of jail that we get to talk about called Rockstar.
Boondock Saints 2.
No, it's death. And twitch it to death.
If you're new to the podcast, go back this time last year, Airheads. If you need to cleanse the palate just a little bit from Pulp Fiction, Airheads is a real good one.
Yeah.
Let's go, baby.
And you can probably finally find that streaming on some different platforms.
Fucking hopefully.
Pretty positive you can, thanks to Brendan Fraser, Academy Award winner.
Wow.
Guys, thank you so much for listening to the show. If you're listening and you haven't subscribed to this show yet, most people will just listen to a show and they aren't even subscribed. So please smash that follow button, whatever they say. But give us a follow, subscribe on the podcast platform that you are listening on. Check us out on YouTube too. Follow us there. Check out everything that we got going on in the set, in the studio. And please follow us on social media. It is at Confused Breakfast. Just search for Confused Breakfast anywhere on social media. Check it out.
Why don't you do that? Go to ConfusedBreakfast.com as well to see the merch that we have. You can buy some shirts to put on your body. You can buy some sweatshirts. I think you can. You get some stickers there. Get some koozies at Not Your Father's on Instagram. Just get some stuff. Just get some stuff and stuff for anybody else. Go to ConfusedBreakfast.com as well to see the ratings of the movies that we have done. You can see my rating of RoboCop. You can see AJ's rating of Roadhouse. You can see Mike's Sam's rating of Raiders of the Last Podcast.
Yeah, whatever that is.
Raiders of the Last Podcast.
Yeah.
So just go there.
Support our sponsors. That is one of the best ways to support this show. Go check all of them out. Support us directly. Patreon.com/ConfusedBreakfast. This show is produced by the Upload Media Group. We got Logs on the controls. Learn more at UploadMediaGroup.com. And we are part of the Cloud 10.fm podcast network. Please check them out to learn more and see some cool shows.
Hey guys, I'm Maggie Lawson.
And I'm her podcast partner in crime, Timothy Ombudson.
And we are the hosts of your new favorite show, The Psychologist RN. Each week, we go episode by episode talking about our favorite moments from psych, sharing behind the scenes stories, incredible memories, and even have drop-ins from our best friends and fellow cast and crew. If this sounds up your alley, listen to The Psychologist RN on the iHeart app, on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.